This is Audible.
Gargoyle, reporting from front lines, jail cells and trap houses. Written and narrated by me, Jake Hanrahan. Copyright 2021, Jake Hanrahan and 90 Kilos Publishing. All rights reserved. About the author. Jake Hanrahan, that's me, is a British journalist and documentary filmmaker from the East Midlands. He covers war and conflict, extremist politics, and organised crime. He's known for his on-the-ground reporting in Syria, Iraq, Kurdistan, Palestine, Hong Kong, Nagorno-Karabakh, Northern Ireland, and more. Hanrahan has worked for HBO, Vice News, The Guardian, Esquire, BBC News, and PBS Frontline, amongst others. His investigative work has won a DuPont Award. Currently, he works as an independent journalist running his own grassroots media collective, Popular Front. See more at jakehanrahan.com. Introduction. In the Middle Ages, gargoyles were fixed onto church walls as a symbol for the masses. They signified the evils that the church would supposedly protect them from. Ironically enough, much of the evil was actually inside the church walls. Even so, for more than 1,000 years, gargoyles have represented the dark side of existence in some form or another. As a kid, I was fascinated with them. I wasn't raised particularly religious or anything, I just liked to look up at them whenever I walked by a church. Those ugly stone monsters. For me, they represented something beyond the conventional. Gargoyles were a symbol of something darker, perhaps, a sign that there's corruption out there. Even as a young lad, this intrigued me. Contrary to what the rules are rules type people told us at school, I knew it all wasn't as simple as good versus evil. I understood this from a young age. As I grew older, my feelings of intrigue towards the unconventional stayed with me. I saw that there were gargoyles everywhere in life. When I became a journalist, I had the chance to focus on such things, but without being pulled entirely into the darkness. I could observe, digest, and try to understand it all. This obsession with the harsher side of life has led me to the front lines of brutal wars, into the crack dens of psychotic criminals, and even landed me in a Turkish prison cell. Gargoyle documents some of that. It's a collection of some of my written work, reporting from what I've seen conventionally as all the wrong crowds. For me, this work has always felt important. It's also exciting and interesting. It's given me a place to stay too. A version of these articles has already been published over the years in various different publications, specifically Vice, Esquire, and Wired. As any journalist will tell you though, some editors have a tendency to absolutely massacre your work. The articles in Gargoyle have all been restored to their original form and context, how I originally wrote it. I think they're better this way, but I would. Gargoyle also acts as a way to showcase some of my reporting in written form, as I'm mostly only known for my documentary work. This book is also probably a good introduction to the kind of journalism I do. Beware though, it's not intended for the squeamish or easily offended. For some, Gargoyle will have you shaking your head like Saint Bernard. Saint Bernard of Clairvaux was a 10th century abbot from France. He did not like gargoyles. He hated them. He wrote about them, calling them fantastic monsters. He didn't mean that in a positive way either. They bothered him. The gargoyles made him uncomfortable. "What is the meaning of these unclean monkeys?" he wrote. "These strange, savage lions and monsters. To what purpose are here placed these creatures, half beast, half man?" The grotesque sculptures rattled Saint Bernard's cage in his own holy house. I love the idea of this, of gargoyles riling up the pious. I think those lucky enough to live in the warmth should at least be made aware of those outside. From the mountains to the mailbox. A weekend with a dark web drug dealer. 2017. Deep in the Moroccan mountains, a large brick building sat in the basin of a valley. It was night. A dull light crept out from the windowless holes in the walls. I was in a car headed down a dirt track towards the building with a man calling himself Patron, Spanish for boss. It had taken us 5 hours to get there, driving up through the mountains via cliff edge roads that were scattered with gendarme checkpoints. Every time we were stopped, the police would open the door and shake Patron's hand. They always had big grins on their faces. I'm paying these guys off all the way from here to the coast, laughed Patron. The journey to the valley made me feel sick. The tarmac roads had ended a good 5 miles back, and the driver had pulled several pointless 180 turns without warning to throw off any tracking signals. Eventually, we pulled up outside the brick building and got out. The driver beeped the horn and a man in overalls emerged. He hugged Patron. They spoke for several minutes in French before leading me through a metal door at the front. Inside the modest brick building, there were bags of cannabis the size of hay bales. They were stacked up to the ceiling. I think that's about 2 tons of weed, said Patron. I think he was about right. A large quantity of the weed belonged to him. It was his product. It wouldn't be sold on the street, though. These drugs would be wrapped up in small packages and delivered by the postman. Patron, as he said himself, is not a gangster. Not in the typical sense, anyway. Patron is a large-scale dark web drug dealer. The dark web being the hidden anonymous internet within the internet that can only be accessed via special encrypted software. Patron sells opium and premium quality hash online on the dark web and claims to be making around £100,000 a month in Bitcoin in the process. His drugs are distributed all over the world after he pushes them into a postbox. The postman is unknowingly his distributor. The dark web drugs markets began with the notorious Silk Road, headed by Dread Pirate Roberts, or DPR. The FBI shut down Silk Road in 2013 when they arrested DPR, identified as 32-year-old Ross Ulbricht. The former dark web kingpin was handed a brutal prison term. 2 life sentences without parole, along with 20 years and 15 years for other charges, including conspiracy to launder money, conspiracy to commit computer hacking, conspiracy to traffic narcotics by the means of the internet, and continuing a criminal enterprise. The FBI's aim was to put an end to the brazen rise of online drug distribution. But what they actually did was create a hydra. When Silk Road was around, there was only one real competitor, Black Market Reloaded. Now there are over 15 dark web drugs markets, many of them with much more robust security than Silk Road. It could be argued that the dark web drug scene has never had so many options. For Patron, who sells his product on the new sites like Hansa Market and Alphabay, the dark web is a place where he believes he can ethically sell drugs. Like most in this community, he doesn't consider himself a criminal. Look, there are criminals and there are criminals, he said as we walked through the building to a back room. If you drink and drive, you're a criminal. If you speed, you're a criminal. If you've got cancer and decide to source your own cannabis to alleviate the pain, you're a criminal. I think, rather than rely on the government to decide what's good and bad for you, you should make your own mind up. Patron paused to light a cigarette, something he'd do every few minutes. If he wasn't chain-smoking, he was sucking on a vape. With the dark web, we help people obtain what they want in a safe and secure manner. They're not forced to go to a heroin dealer in some shady place on the street. We're letting them sit on their sofa and get their drugs delivered. Whilst Patron doesn't at first glance strike you as the kind of guy that wanted to be known as the boss, he did have an edge to him. Seeing him deal with his business partners in the mountains was an education. One minute he was the most charismatic person in the room, The next he was aloof and serious, cold even. He switched rapidly. The more we talked, though, the more he seemed, deep down, to be a bit of a geek. A tough geek, sure, but a geek all the same. He was genuinely fascinated with OPSEC, operational security, computers, technology, and hardware. Earlier in the day, for example, as we walked along the docks in Morocco, Patron pointed out all the Coast Guard speedboats in the water. He knew the names, the model numbers, which engines they used, how fast they could go, and what kind of security personnel would be manning them. Patron wasn't a drug dealer who'd fallen into the dark web world, but a dark web guy who'd fallen into the drugs world. This is perhaps what's currently keeping him one step ahead of the authorities. Patron reached into a sack in the back room of the cannabis safe house and dumped several kilos of pressed hash and 3 bags of shake onto a table. Shake is cannabis that's ground down into a fine dust. It's potent and expensive. "There we go," he said. "That's my next shipment. That's coming over with the team soon." His team being a group he calls Cartel Norte Africa, or CNA, or North African Cartel in English. The CNA is a small team of Spaniards and Berbers, indigenous North Africans, headed by Patron. They work in both Morocco and in Spain. With the help of CNA, Patron can get his product smuggled from North Africa to Europe, where it's then distributed all over the world from the orders the team receives via the dark web. "Right now, I'm doing quarter-ton shipments, 250 kilos each run," said Patron. "Depends on how much the clients want, but we're doing about 2 runs every month." Patron explained that while he makes decent money from this, he's by no means a rich man. "I live well, but I have to pay everyone in the team. I have to pay for my own personal security team, the farmers, smugglers, everyone. I want everyone to get their fair cut. But that's why I work with these guys here, to get the premium product for a fair price. These farms have been in operation for generations." Patron opened a bag of shake. The smell filled the whole room. "Once the plants are grown, they're cut, dried, and the shake is prepared and the hash is made from that. We then transport using a number of vehicles. Once the blocks of hash have been pressed at the brick building in the valley, Patron then loads them onto flatbed trucks. They're transported to a coastal region of Morocco, where they're placed onto rigid inflatable boats. The boats have around 5 300-horsepower motors on them," he explained. "They're very fast boats. It's just a fucking blur when you're on them. It's scary. We then head towards Spain, offloading everything at the coast when it arrives. From here, the drugs are taken to safe houses. This was our next destination. That night we slept in a half-constructed building with no heating. It was fucking freezing, but apparently the only place around, according to Patron. We woke early and drank homemade coffee. Patron chain-smoked as he tried to get signal on his phone. I wandered around for a bit. The mist was so heavy it felt like we were in the clouds. I found the bumper of an old car dashed on a cliff edge amongst beer bottles and sweet wrappers. The number plate was from Poland. The rest of the car was probably in the valley over the edge of the cliff. I couldn't see because of the mist. I didn't want to risk getting too close to the edge either. Up in these mountains, anything could disappear. There was no help for miles around. It was the perfect location for Patron's operations. After a few hours, Patron took a call and decided it was now time to leave Morocco. He'd show me the other half of the business. We left for Spain. Every time we arrived at a new location, Patron would methodically swap the SIM cards in both of his phones before placing them into special bags that shut off all signal. He'd also stash 2 of his passports, the 2 that I saw him with at least, in whichever car came to pick us up. In Spain, over the space of a 3-hour journey from the coast to a safe house, we changed car 2. The 2nd time at the side of a road with no streetlights or barriers. Patron was paranoid, and rightly so. If caught, he could face up to 15 years in prison. "Okay," said Patron cautiously, pulling on a cigarette as he checked his mirror. "We're coming up to the safe house now." We sped down a dark track through the middle of nowhere, eventually pulling into a small courtyard with a few houses. 2 young men approached and hugged Patron. The 3 of them spoke Spanish among themselves. After a few minutes, Patron and I headed into the safe house as the two men peeled off into the courtyard somewhere. The inside of the safe house looked like a cyberpunk hideout. There were several laptops, messy wiring, a huge flat screen TV, and USB card readers all over the place. There was a settee and a table and some leftovers. On the wall there was a long range hunting rifle with a mounted scope. I asked Patron if he liked to hunt. "Yeah, I like to hunt," he replied. A pause. "I tell you what though, if he shot someone with that it would fucking hurt." Patron vanished into another room before returning with a laptop and another sack. He emptied the sack onto the table. A kilo of Amnes hash and a large puck-shaped brick of opium. Patron plugged a USB stick into the laptop. It booted up. "I use Tails, you see." He pointed at the USB stick. "Tails is an operating system that's used for maintaining privacy online. It blocks all non-anonymous connections and forces all its outgoing connections through Tor, a web browser designed to keep the user anonymous. Basically, anyone selling drugs on the internet without Tails is much more likely to get caught." Once logged into the dark web markets, Patron checked his orders. There were quite a few. Business was clearly going well. "Here we go," he said. "This woman wants hash. I'll show you how we do it." He clicked around a few times and then lit up another cigarette. Watching Patron at work in the safe house on his computer doing the orders was like watching a good mechanic fix a car. He was absolutely in his element and knew by instinct how to work. Suddenly, there was a mechanical grinding sound. It was a printer booting up in the corner. A fake invoice for a gym membership came out. Without saying a word, Patron pulled on a pair of surgical gloves, grabbed a knife from his coat pocket, and headed to a desk in the corner of the room. He took the invoice and a block of hash with him. There was a portable fan heater at his feet. He switched it on and stuck the knife in between the metal grill. He placed the block of hash on a chopping board and lit up another cigarette, having left his last one unfinished in an ashtray. "Look," he said, pausing to inhale. "Okay, yeah, I am doing something that the government classes as illegal, but on a moral standpoint, I think it's perfectly reasonable." Patron went off on a tangent while he waited for the knife to heat up. He told me that his dream, ultimately, was to someday open up a health clinic of sorts, a place where experimental drug treatments with CBD, the non-psychoactive chemical in cannabis, can be done legally. Then the knife was hot. Patron stubbed out his half-smoked cigarette and got to work, chopping off about a gram of hash from the block by eye. He then wrapped it in cling film, glued it to the back of the invoice, folded it all up and popped it into an envelope. The drugs were hidden. "There you go," he laughed. "You get that in the mail and open it up and it's just a gym invoice." Patron is perhaps as much a product of the internet as he is the drugs war. Sat in the safe house, surrounded by laptops, cigarettes and drugs, he seemed to be more at home than in the mountains where he was doing the more dangerous work. For him, the money and the lifestyle aren't worth it if he doesn't have the community and the camaraderie of the dark web. As he said himself, "I like what DPR believed in. He created a new culture." Before I finally said goodbye to Patron, I asked him what it is he loves so much about the dark web drugs markets he operates on. "Generally, on the dark web, everyone is trying to get along," he said. "They solve their disputes through admins on the markets, and it's all very civilized and very nice. Then there's the bulk drug transport business. The stuff that happens outside of the internet. Think about it. That's been going on since the actual Silk Road, the ancient trade route through Asia. And it's ironic, as this all started with violence, with the opium wars and what have you, and now, without the dark web and the Silk Road marketplace, it all ends with violence."
Efes Molotovs, a Kurdish riot in Istanbul, 2014/2021. The first time I met the YDGH, they were rioting on the streets of Turkey, throwing petrol bombs with makeshift balaclavas pulled over their heads. The YDGH being the urban youth wing of the PKK, a Kurdish militant group battling the Turkish regime. I first met the YDGH in Istanbul, some 900 miles away from the historic boundaries of North Kurdistan. It was summer 2014.
ISIS was spreading like wildfire across Iraq and Syria. The jihadists had reached Turkey's border in the south of the country as they attacked the Kurdish city of Kobani in northern Syria. In Kobani, civilians, young and old, were murdered in the streets. Their homes were raided and torched. Vehicles were converted into bombs. Corpses lay strewn amongst the rubble. ISIS had come to raise their black flag and were massacring anyone in their way. Across the border in southeast Turkey, the vast majority of residents are Kurdish. Roughly 10 million Kurds live in the southeast. From their own front doors, they could see black smoke rising over Kobani as ISIS tried to raise the city. Shelling and gunfire rang out all night as local Kurdish militias in Kobani attempted to fight back. As the clashes raged on, the Turkish military watched passively from the border. They did nothing. Kurds in Turkey mobilized themselves and tried to cross to assist in the battle, but Turkish soldiers denied them. It began to look as if the Turkish government was happy to have ISIS as their neighbor, so long as it meant they wiped out the Kurds who were there before them. The Kurds of southeast Turkey were enraged. Meanwhile, PKK militants grabbed their weapons and swarmed to Kobani from their base in the nearby Kandil Mountains of Iraq. For the first time in decades, they weren't fighting Turkey, but a new enemy, ISIS. On September 27, 2014, the US began hitting ISIS with airstrikes across Kobani. All day long, US airplanes could be seen showering bombs over the city. In October, they conducted 39 airstrikes in just 2 days. This section of the Turkish border became a campout for journalists from all over the world. As the spectacle of airstrikes and distant tracer rounds continued in northeast Syria, angry protests began to break out all across Turkey. The Kurds grew increasingly furious that the Turkish government, who at that time was trying to normalize relations with their Kurdish brothers, wouldn't let them defend their own people in Kobani. The rowdy but often non-violent protests were met with police water cannon and tear gas. This is when the YDGH first began to make noise. In response, they mobilized into an urban youth group of rage, forming franchises in dozens of cities across Turkey. They'd shout Tolhildan and Sehildan, Kurdish for revenge and uprising, as they lobbed rocks and fired pistols at police. They formed strategies for clashing in the streets against the security forces and shared them via WhatsApp with YDGH cells in other cities. Soon the tactics spread throughout the whole of Turkey. At this time, in 2014, the YDGH was almost unheard of outside of the Kurdish community and the Turkish press. I've been told about them through a friend of a friend. I was interested. Most of the world's conflict journalists were headed out to the Syrian border to watch the airstrikes. I didn't want to do that. That area was already saturated. People were joking that there were more reporters on the border than refugees. Instead, I wanted to cover the YDGH clashes in the cities. Back then, I was working for Vice News. This is when it was in its infancy, before the HBO money came in and ruined everything. It was amazing back then. Things were very raw and makeshift. You didn't have to sit about in pitch meetings for hours to get your ideas heard. You could just corner your editor and have a word. If you had a good idea, you'd be on a plane within days. I was able to convince my boss that I could get decent enough access to the YDGH in Istanbul. We'd make a news documentary about why they were clashing in the streets with Turkish police instead of heading off to Kobani to fight ISIS. The boss man liked it. I was teamed up with my close friend and cameraman, Phil Pendlebury. Within a week, we were in Istanbul. It was my first time in Turkey. I was 24 years old and had only been working properly as a conflict journalist for about 6 months. Being in Istanbul, for me, was incredible. We based ourselves just outside of Okmaydan, a rundown neighborhood in the city where the most violent clashes were taking place. Okmaydan sits on the west side of Istanbul, around a 40-minute drive from the Bosphorus Strait. The strait splits the city into two halves, the European side and the Asian side. Residents of Okmaydan are mostly a mix of Kurds and Turks. Their ideologies vary, as can be seen by the graffiti dedicated to different leftist groups sprayed over every wall in the neighborhood. There were maybe a dozen different armed political street groups operating in Okmaydan at that time. YDGH, Dev Gench, DHKPC, TIKO, to name a few. They tolerated one another, but long-running disputes between the various revolutionary factions were constant. It wasn't unheard of for gun battles to break out between feuding groups. The only thing the whole of Okmaydan seemed to agree on was that they absolutely did not like President Erdogan. Within about 15 minutes of entering Okmaydan, a young lad of about 13 years old ran up to me and shouted, "Erdogan Katil." Erdogan is a murderer. After a few days dipping in and out of the neighborhood, speaking to the locals about YDGH, I was invited to attend a public funeral march in Okmaydan. A young Turkish man from the area had been killed in Kobani. His name was Sufi Nejat Aganazli. He died 2 weeks earlier whilst fighting ISIS. Aganazli was a devoted Marxist and anti-fascist. He saw the Kurdish struggle in Rojava as one aligned with his own leftist beliefs, so he travelled out to fight alongside the Kurdish YPG militia. In a letter written to his parents before he left, he said it was his duty to help defend Kobani. Whilst in battle, Aganazli was shot first in the stomach and then in the spine as his friend tried to drag him to safety. 2 rounds from an M16 tore through his kidney and shattered his vertebrae. Nothing could be done to save his life. He was just 29 years old. Phil and me headed down to film the funeral procession in Okmaydan. Young men and women had gathered on the streets to commemorate Aganazli's death. They carried a long banner with his smiling face in it as they moved through the winding alleyways of the neighborhood. Loud Middle Eastern music boomed from a stereo system rigged to the back of a truck that followed the crowd. Some of the people wept as they cried out, "Long live the resistance," in Kurdish. The march went on for about an hour, with supporters and members of many different Okmaydan militant factions attending. The disputes were on ice for now. Aganazli was a Turkish communist but had died defending Kurds in a foreign land. His death was one of true solidarity. Okmaydan recognised that. As it got dark, police riot vans began pulling up to the entrance of the neighbourhood. The occasional squawk of the sirens could be heard a few blocks away. The procession of mourners, around 200 people at this point, stopped at an intersection. The mood had changed. Everyone turned their heads. A small group of young men wearing balaclavas had filtered into the procession. They moved past me, strutting confidently through the crowd. They stepped into the center and held up a megaphone. People smiled and whispered amongst themselves. They weren't intimidated. They were excited. "We invite the youth of Okmaydan to go to Kobani, to pay our dues and fulfill our duty of honour," said one of the masked men. "As long as the attacks continue, our lives cannot be normal. Martyrs do not die. Martyrs do not die," the crowd chanted back. Their voices echoed loudly throughout the narrow streets and graffiti-covered buildings of Okmaydan. The young men in balaclavas were members of the Istanbul cell of the YDGH. The crowd dispersed quickly after the speech. The lads in masks took off one way, with around 50 others following them. I tagged along, running to the front to speak to the commander of the group. He was lean, in his early 20s, and went by the alias Zagros. He was smoking a cigarette through his balaclava and swapping phones with one of his friends. Something was clearly happening. With the help of an interpreter, I asked if I could follow them. He looked around for a minute. "Okay," he nodded. "Just don't film anyone without a mask on." There was distant shouting up the road. The police trucks had entered Okmaydan. We all ran to a dark intersection where each main road seemed to connect to the next via grids of narrow alleyways and shortcuts. Zagros told us to wait. The youth vanished, scurrying into the darkness. Younger lads began emerging from the alleyways. They couldn't have been more than 11 years old. They carried bags of rubbish with them, which they dumped across the main roads to form little barricades. They doused the bags in petrol and set them alight. They stood to the side of the road, watching the flames melt the plastic bags. For a moment, it felt like everyone in Okmaidan had fallen silent. The only sounds were those of the neighbourhood. The sporadic shriek of the sirens, the popping of burning plastic, dry brakes squeaking on a bike somewhere. Then we heard chanting slowly rising from the alleyways. It grew louder. A crowd of young YDGH members emerged from the darkness. They doubled. There were around 80 of them now. All had their faces covered with balaclavas, tied up t-shirts or old rags with holes cut out for the eyes. They wore gloves and some had socks pulled over their trainers. I'd later learned that they naively figured that the police wouldn't be able to identify them this way. Most of these young men and some women were teenagers. They all marched single file like soldiers. In unison, they threw up victory signs with their fingers and continued to chant their songs about the Kurdish resistance. Once they'd all filtered into the street, they dropped holdalls on the pavement and unzipped them. Each was filled with petrol bombs. Zagros showed me them all lined up in the bag. I laughed because they were made using empty bottles of Efes, a cheap Turkish lager I'd been drinking all week. These Efes bottles were now filled with oil and petrol, with a damp petrol rag hanging from the top. Molotov cocktails. The youth gathered round and took a bottle each. They lit them up. Quickly, the young militants spread out through the alleyways, their shadows dancing across the walls by the light of their Molotovs. The police were close now, firing huge tear gas grenades from the turrets on their trucks. The grenades smashed into the walls. Each one was aimed at head height. White clouds of tear gas rose from the canisters. It engulfed us. It felt like my eyes were burning out of my skull. A few of the youth booted the canisters back up the road. Some seemed almost immune to the gas. Everyone began to scramble. Half blind, I ducked my head down and ran with them. I caught up and followed closely behind Zagros as he dashed through the alleyways with a few of his friends. We ran up through side streets, leapt over a wall, and sprinted across an intersection to a small alleyway. They had this area mapped out in their heads. Zagros took a position at the edge of the alley. Him and three others jumped out into the street and pelted a police truck with their Molotovs. It was roughly 20 feet away. Zagros's aim was perfect. His bottle smashed into a grill that was bolted across one of the truck's windscreens. Flames washed across the front of the vehicle for a moment. Zagros moved quickly, sprinting off to a second position. This was happening all over the neighbourhood. Fireworks, Molotovs and rocks were being used to attack the police at every corner. At one point, a lad opposite us pulled a handgun from his belt and fired five rounds at the police trucks up the road. He shouted, looked across at me and Phil, then pointed the gun at us. "Whoa, whoa, whoa," I shouted to him from across the road. Useless, of course. He kept the gun aimed straight. Phil lowered the camera. The gunman shouted angrily at us in Turkish as we backed away behind a parked car. Luckily, he lowered the gun and ran off down the road. It was only then that I noticed the small crowd of children gathered on the corner, probably only 10 yards from where the gunman had shot at the police. After an hour or so, Okmaidan was trashed. Piles of rubbish burned in the streets, shattered glass and petrol covered every road, and the steady response from the police left each alleyway filled with a white haze of tear gas. I sat ducked around a corner with Zagros as he paused for a smoke. He pulled up his trouser leg to show me a swelling on his ankle. He explained that he'd been in similar clashes the week before and had been injured by a tear gas canister. "Just as the YPG continue to fight whilst wounded, we too will keep resisting," he said. He was revving himself up. A few of his friends nearby echoed the sentiment. Suddenly, from each corner, the chanting of YDGH rose. They shouted each letter in their mother tongue. Yeah, de, ge, hash. As the chants of his friends got louder, Zagros sprang into action. He ran out from the corner and took cover behind an electric box. He lit up a large firework and aimed it at the police. A volley of red sparks shot from the cardboard tube and exploded all around the police trucks up the road. The police fired back. Two tear gas grenades. They smashed straight into the adjacent side of the electric box. A cloud of tear gas soon surrounded Zagros. Coughing, he crouched down and started shaking his head. "Breathe, breathe," shouted one of his mates in the mist. Zagros rubbed at his face through the eye holes in his balaclava. He spoke to himself briefly, then stood up amidst the tear gas. "You murderers will soon see how brave the Kurdish people are," he shouted. "As long as the PKK are in the mountains and the YPG are in Kobani, we will be on the streets fighting." Back then, the YDGH was a small group of angry Kurdish youth throwing rocks and petrol bombs at police. Within 6 months, they'd led a small-scale war against the Turkish government, which would leave hundreds dead and thousands imprisoned. Freedom Club Revival: How the Unabomber Became Relevant Again. 2018. In 1978, Ted Kaczynski began building letter bombs designed to kill. They were made out of smokeless powder, match heads, nails, potassium nitrate, razor blades, and various other caustic substances. Kaczynski, a former academic and alumnus of Harvard University, killed 3 people with these bombs and injured 23 others. His targets were airliners, university professors, and academics. Some of the bombs missed their targets and blew shrapnel into the bodies of postal workers and receptionists. The attacks were unscrupulous and vicious. Kaczynski, dubbed the Unabomber by the FBI and the media, evaded capture for almost 18 years. He'd been hiding out in a self-contained wood cabin in the forests of Montana, writing a manifesto under the pseudonym Freedom Club, or FC, on a portable typewriter. After releasing his 35,000-word manifesto titled Industrial Society and Its Future to the media in 1995, it became apparent that Kaczynski was fighting, in his mind at least, against the rise of technology and the perceived sickness it had infected the world with. The Unabomber was effectively a militant neo-Luddite. 22 years after Kaczynski's bombing campaign and imprisonment, he now has a new following. Ironically enough, they all congregate on the internet. Often characterized by putting pine tree emojis in their names on social media, the new Kaczynski-inspired community of self-defined primitivists and neo-Luddites is flourishing. They spend hours sharing memes that call for the destruction of modern civilization. They discuss fringe politics in Twitter group chats or on the Discord messaging app. This year, they even sent Kaczynski a birthday card. On the face of it, Kaczynski's new followers are angry, bored, and sick of the modern world. In part, this revival of Kaczynski's ideas is spurred on further by a TV drama series called Manhunt Unabomber, which aired in August 2017. The series tells a fictionalized version of the Unabomber investigation. In the process of catching the elusive felon, the main character, Agent Fitz, pores over Kaczynski's manifesto until he develops an affinity with it. He comes to the conclusion that while the brutal bombing campaign was wrong, Kaczynski's theories were actually right. The detective ends up moving into a log cabin in the woods. Kaczynski ends up moving into prison with 8 life sentences. Large parts of the series are factually inaccurate. For example, the portrayal of Kaczynski as some kind of CIA experiment gone wrong and the insinuation that he was mentally ill. But overall, Manhunt Unabomber seems to have provided an easily consumerable entryway to Kaczynski's politics for many in the pine tree community. To say that the renewed Unabomber interest was launched entirely off the back of this series is wrong, as there have been many in post-left political circles that have for decades spread the ideas of Kaczynski. The series did, however, help to consolidate the ideas for many of the younger adherents. Like Agent Fitz in Manhunt, the new Kaczynski followers are drawn to his theories. In this sense, there is somewhat of a Freedom Club revival happening. Hundreds of young men seeking the reconnection with nature as an act of rebellion against the state of Western civilization, all couched in Ted Kaczynski's anti-tech ideas. For a year now, I've been chatting with various members of the Pine Tree community. They're a mixed bag. Some seem to actually want the total destruction of modern civilization and long for some kind of apocalyptic future. Some are sick of the mainstream's political correctness. Some are, of course, just shitposting. But all of them are definitely disgusted with modernity. In an age of hyper-consumerism and ecological destruction, the pine trees don't see a place for themselves anywhere within the current system. They long for something radical. "Modernity crushes your soul," said Reggie, who's been part of the new pine tree community from the beginning. "We see our jobs as soul-crushing. Modern life is safe and boring and lacking cohesion. Many strive for a more simple and practical existence." Reggie, 18, became aware of Kaczynski's crimes and manifesto in December 2017 after seeing Manhunt Unabomber memes posted online. He got hold of a copy of the manifesto and was immediately converted. "I read the manifesto and it blew my mind," he said. "I thought it was a work of genius." In the 6 months I've been speaking to Reggie, he's gone from meme posting daily about how much he wants the modern world to collapse to actually going out and spending time immersed in nature, hiking through the forests where he lives in Canada. He's seen online less and less. But Kaczynski's terrorism hasn't influenced Reggie. He doesn't agree with his brutal murders and doesn't believe that they were justified, as some pine trees do. "Killing innocents isn't a good thing, and I find his justification for it shitty," said Reggie. "If he wanted to kill someone, why not assassinate, like, Steve Jobs or one of those corporate assholes?" Like Reggie, most of the new young Kaczynskiites don't actually want to set the world on fire. They're probably not about to start building bombs in their kitchens or ditching their smartphones to live in the woods. But they do feel something is wrong. Between the memes you see these young men posting on their timelines, often anything that mocks society or a semi-ironic wish for a war they can die in, you'll see a genuine fury at the seemingly endless cycle of nature being destroyed in pursuit of profit. That's not to say they side with your average environmentalist, though. In fact, they laugh in the face of organizations like Greenpeace and the World Wildlife Fund. Their argument is that these people all work within the system, so how can they really change anything? The pine trees feel it's all a little too late. Maybe it is. To quote the Dark Mountain Project, a collective of former mainstream ecologists who went rogue and came around to a similar way of thinking as Kaczynski, "We were disillusioned with the state of environmentalism. It seemed that sustainability had come to mean sustaining the Western way of living at all costs." Through their crass shitposting and memes about militant groups like the Animal Liberation Front, the pine trees are often trying to say the same thing, albeit through the haze of a 21st century internet subculture. Conflict is a constant presence on the pine tree timeline. They spread their message through tweeting things like "shut the fuck up urbanite" at Silicon Valley tech bros, normies, or basically anyone who doesn't agree with them. Instead of engaging others in public debate, they'd rather trash them. They don't want allies. The aesthetics of war plays a big part too. Photos of the Provisional IRA, the EZLN, and even Russian-backed separatists in East Ukraine are often posted alongside joking messages such as, "I wish that were me." One user, Eco Retard, recently tweeted, "Can I get an urban conflict with a faction I support so I can die for something I believe in?" The glorification of war is perhaps another way of expressing their frustration at feeling trapped. As Reggie said, modern life is safe and boring. War, or at least the detached romanticization of it, is not. Now, this community of Kaczynski adherents, misfits, and so-called political extremists is less a cohesive movement than a loosely connected online subculture. For a while, though, there was a pine tree leader of sorts. He was less concerned with the shitposting and more seriously occupied with the Kaczynski worldview. His name is Rin. He wanted to build an organization of dedicated people. He indexed Kaczynski's prison letters, memorized paragraph numbers of the manifesto, and corralled the first new wave of Kaczynskiites into a community. Rin, 24, also ran the most extensive online Kaczynski archive that has probably ever existed. That is until he pulled it all down in disgust last month. I decided to dedicate myself to the Ted Kaczynski Project because everyone was talking about the Unabomber, but no one was talking about Ted Kaczynski's ideas, Rin told me. Rin has been involved in post-left and green anarchist politics since he was 18. He lives in a Spanish-speaking country, considers himself a neo-Luddite, and tries to follow the teachings of Kaczynski wherever possible. I've spent a lot of time in the last 6 months debating Rin and discussing his radical ideology with him. He's intelligent and well-read. Despite his preoccupation with Kaczynski, I never got the impression that Rin was actually dangerous, although he can most definitely be considered a Kaczynski sympathizer. He used to run three different Twitter accounts, two of which were Ted Kaczynski Archive and Ted Was Right. Kaczynski's victims are never a focus of the discussion and are coldly shrugged off as a simple consequence of war. When Rin noticed the emergence of a small online community of young men interested in all things Unabomber at the start of 2018, he began to round them up. He formed a group chat on Twitter and a radical book club where he would suggest new political literature for the pine trees. He and the rest of them embraced edgy irony and warlike aesthetics as a means to draw the youth in further. It was all very deliberate. Manhunt Unabomber was the perfect breeding ground to introduce the ideology to suitable people, Rin said. The people attracted to the ideas began interacting with each other and formed themselves into a social base. They were able to form a community and slowly develop a culture. This was what eventually became Prim Twitter, primitivist Twitter being another name for the Pine Tree community. Whilst the Pine Tree members were from a variety of different political milieus, they were all united by Rin under a popular front that embraced collapse and loved nature. But Rin's place at the head of the community didn't last. His own creation began to morph into something unforgivably ugly when some members began drifting from edgy Luddite memes and the embrace of wild nature to outright far-right ideologies. Some in the community began flirting with fascism, Rin said, and not the left-wing type where everything they dislike is labelled fascism, but actual, genuine fascism. That was the final drop in the bucket for me. Totalitarian ideologies like fascism and communism are something I am extremely hostile against. Rin is quick to emphasise that despite many on the left considering Kaczynski a fascist, mostly due to the fact he attacked them constantly in his manifesto, Kaczynski actually describes fascism as kook ideology, page 150 of his book Technological Slavery. And he also said Nazi ideology is evil in one of his letters. Rin also points out that Kaczynski has never tried to align himself with fascists. In fact, he was in favour of radical black liberation groups and always saw green anarchist types as his natural comrades. This doesn't change the fact that many fascist groups today use Kaczynski as an icon. Even Atomwaffen Division, the esoteric neo-Nazi militant group in the US, have made graphics using his face. Ted Kaczynski himself, though, has never aligned with fascism, and it's true he's acted consciously to push back against far-right ideologies. Some of the Pine Tree community are now splintering off into different groups, deviating from Kaczynski's work to that of Pentti Linkola, who is described often as an eco-fascist. This coincides with the new ecologically focused neo-Nazi groups that are now frequently cropping up. Green fringe politics is all very much in vogue on the internet, as is the resurgence of neo-fascism. The two are starting to merge. Rin scrapped his online Kaczynski archive in June due to the creep of fascism amongst the pine trees, but he still believes that a new generation of neo-Luddism is coming. There is very much an interest in Ted Kaczynski growing deep down, he said. It's in its infancy, but it seems Ted being in prison has finally paid off. He's gotten some extremely dedicated Neo-Luddites ready to contribute to the collapse of technological society. Rin may sound militant, but the likelihood of a major Neo-Luddite terror attack remains pretty low. The Freedom Club revival is still mostly spreading via memes online, not via letter bombs. The idea that our interaction with technology has reached a crisis point is spreading further than the Pine Tree Fringe ideology, though. This year, the theme has been featured often in the press. Even Silicon Valley, which made tech junkies out of us all, is having a twinge of guilt. Some reformed tech bros have created humane tech organizations, such as the Time Well Spent movement, founded by former Google employee Tristan Harris. The Pine Tree community is a radical response to what writer Grafton Tanner once called the Mall, a digital hellscape where people are nostalgic for something that never existed, constantly doped on consumer goods, energy drinks, and Apple products. In Rin's opinion, it's all falling down already. Our technological civilization is complex and unsustainable. Its breakdown is inevitable, he said. It will be slow and boring, but technological civilization has already signed its death warrant.
Nothing is true and everything is possible in the Donetsk People's Republic. Behind East Ukraine's Iron Curtain, 2016. In March 2014, Russian-backed separatists began to forcibly take control of large areas of East Ukraine. They started riots, invaded government buildings, and set up roadblocks. They were opposed to the Ukraine revolution, favouring the ousted pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych. With him gone and the country moving towards Europe, the separatists took up arms. With the help of Russian-supplied firepower such as tanks and Grad missiles, the separatists fought off Ukrainian troops. The insurgency turned into a full-scale war. At that time, the Ukrainians were poorly trained and ill-equipped. After nearly 3 years of conflict, though, they've grown battle-hardened and have fought to regain ground. They've pushed the separatists back to their stronghold in the Donbass, a large coal mining district that borders Russia to the east. Now, however, with the conflict's second official ceasefire underway, both sides are dug in. This has turned the war into a slow but constant battle from the trenches. As neither side advances, the two self-declared separatist states of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic are working on gaining legitimacy. They declared independence in 2014 when the conflict started. Despite the violence displacing around 1.7 million people, they don't view themselves as separatists, but as liberators. Their politics is infused with a nostalgia for authoritarian communist rule, specifically USSR-era Stalinism. That and a heady mix of warzone banditry. The Donetsk People's Republic, or the DNR, is the most prominent separatist group, and they've set up a state of the same name. They don't offer up access to the region as often as they used to, and they've banned many journalists, but for some reason, they let me in. They did so on the condition that I'd be allocated minders for my stay. I travelled there with the help of a local fixer. It took around 3 hours in total to get there from Ukraine-held territory. After driving past the last Ukraine barrier and through a narrow, heavily mined no-man's land, we approached the entrance to the Donetsk People's Republic. Concrete chicanes snaked through checkpoints made out of breeze blocks and rotting sandbags. Militants dressed in a jumble of green combat fatigues were standing around smoking with their rifles slung over their shoulders. There wasn't a set of matching camouflage between them. After border guards checked our accreditation, we were waved past the checkpoints and into the heart of the DNR. The city of Donetsk is pleasant enough. The roads are wide, there's lots of grass, public transport seemed fairly frequent. Unfortunately, most of this is undone by the constant presence of gunmen and the overt signs of DNR takeover. Stiff-faced militants roamed around everywhere. At the bus stop, at the cigarette stalls, at the cafes, they supplement the DNR propaganda, which is scattered all over the city centre. The garish blue and yellow of the Ukraine flag has been replaced with the black, blue and red of the separatists.
There's a 20-foot Soviet-esque mural of a separatist fighter holding up a little boy who's released a dove from his hands. On the cars even, lots of the Ukraine number plates have been replaced with the unofficial DNR ones. The nearly Russian but not Russian flags hang everywhere. The separatists have gone all out, even renaming McDonald's Don Mac, as in Donetsk Mac. We drove to the Ramada, one of only two hotels still open in Donetsk. I was due to meet the DNR minders there, or guides as they call them. In the restaurant, I met Yanis Putkonin, the head of the DNR's foreign media communications. He couldn't shake hands properly as his right hand was wrapped in a bandage with a splint. I was out drinking with some comrades at the sauna, he explained. We were dancing around and I slipped over and completely crushed my hand. Yanis Putkonin is a big man. He's 42 and stands at about 6'3", with broad shoulders and dark, slicked back hair. He had a small entourage of DNR affiliates with him. Maria, his assistant slash translator slash possible girlfriend, a guy with an anvil head who didn't speak, and Vittorio Rangeloni, a 24-year-old Italian communist who had spent his life savings of 3,000 euros to move to the DNR. There's a small stream of European communists moving to Donetsk. Most of them believe that the brutal authoritarianism of the USSR was good for the people, and so they're happy to excuse any dictatorships so long as they're painted red. In many radical leftist circles, these sorts of communists are known as tankies, named so after the time Stalin sent in tanks to crush the 1956 Hungarian Revolution against USSR totalitarianism. Putkonin can, without a doubt, be described as an old-school tankie. He was one of the first Europeans to move to the DNR, longing for a Soviet era he was never part of. Putkonin is originally from Finland. He doesn't speak Russian or Ukrainian, nor has he tried to learn. He made his way to the DNR shortly after the war started. "I wanted to see what was happening for myself," he said. "I saw that this place was giving power back to the people, so I stayed." Putkonin eventually became the first foreigner to gain citizenship in the DNR. His role there seemed murky. Describing himself as simply a Soviet, he now heads up the DNR's official press service, Donai News, a separatist English language propaganda outlet. It's anti-Western, anti-facts, and completely pro-Russian. Putkonin displayed open contempt for Europe. Without hesitation, he began stating that while he loved his own country, he even had a Finnish flag badge on the lapel of his suit, the government there was his enemy. They'd failed him, he said. A former soap actor and journalist, Putkonin somehow found a place for himself in a rogue separatist state. "Tomorrow we will pick you up at 9 a.m. at the front of the hotel," he said. "We'll take you around, we will accommodate you." He checked his watch, stood up and awkwardly tried to shake hands with his bandaged paw. I fumbled a semi-handshake with his forearm. "Welcome to the free world," he said. They had to leave. It was nearly the 11 p.m. curfew and they had places to be. The next day I waited for the DNR miners outside on the steps of the Ramada. Two cars pulled up, but Conan hopped out of one. He was dressed in combat fatigues with a black cap and sunglasses. Two others followed him. They were also in combat gear but were armed with semi-automatic rifles. Unlike Putkonin, who looked like he was playing dress-up, they held themselves in a way that suggested they were trained. They didn't speak much. Vittorio Rangeloni, the young Italian, would join me everywhere too. He was wearing full combat fatigues with matching knockoff camouflage Air Max 90s. 20 euros at the Donetsk market, he said. The first stop on our tour was a small village called Veseloy on the outskirts of Donetsk, where I was told we'd meet locals. There we met Lubov Pugachenko, a sweet old lady whose house had been shelled by the Ukrainians. Inside there was a hole in the ceiling where a mortar round had blasted through the roof. The floorboards were splintered and scorched, and all the windows had been shattered. "Gypsies live better than us," she said. "My kitchen was destroyed too. A huge bomb took the roof off." Lubov and her husband now live in a small outhouse on the grounds of their destroyed home. The ceilings were low and the rooms were small, but she'd made it cozy enough. In a makeshift kitchen, Lubov prepared fruit and a homemade compote drink. Before the war, we were like brothers and sisters with the Ukrainians, she explained. But now we're enemies. We hate them because they brought the war to us. They started to shoot at us. Yanis and Vittorio nodded and grinned. Lubov had a local DNR newspaper handy on her worktop. On the front was a picture of Alexander Zakhachenko, the appointed prime minister of the DNR. He's the leader, said Lubov. He's very good. He's helping us a lot. She took another look at the paper and gasped. Oh, it isn't Zakhachenko. It is him. It is him, said Rangeloni, quickly interrupting. Is it? He looks so ugly in this picture. You brought me a paper with an ugly picture of him. Everyone laughed, seemingly ignorant of the fact that Lubov had accidentally revealed she was unsure of what Zakhachenko even looked like. She'd also let slip that the miners had brought the paper to her. It was apparent that this press tour they'd taken me on was similar to the kind you'd encounter in North Korea. En route to our next destination, I asked Rangeloni if the reaction from Lubov was representative of civilians in the DNR. Yeah, you could enter into any house and they'd say the same thing, he said. The DNR is just defending their land. People just want to live in peace with the right to speak Russian, because it's Russian land. Rangeloni was naturally quite romantic about the DNR. He'd grown up in Italy with a Russian mother who taught him that the Soviet Union was a great place. He'd been indoctrinated with hardline communism from an early age and jumped at the chance to move to the DNR once it declared independence. He said he was there to spread the truth of their situation, even if he did constantly deny that the Russians were directly involved. This was funny, as the car we were driving had Russian plates, and Pekonin told me it was gifted to him from Moscow. We travelled next to Donetsk Airport, an important battleground throughout the Ukraine war. As Rangeloni said, whoever controls Donetsk Airport controls the entrance to the city. Before the second battle for the airport in September of 2014 and its fall in January 2015, it was the last part of Donetsk still held by Ukrainian forces. Since that particularly brutal round of fighting, it's been in the hands of the separatists. Donetsk Airport is a grey wasteland of gnarled metal and crumbling concrete. Bent rebar pokes out of every structure left standing. The ground is littered with shrapnel, bullet casings and rotting insulation. We went there to meet with an infamous group of separatist fighters known as the Sparta Battalion. Their commander was a Russian named Motorola, who once claimed in a recorded phone conversation with the Kiev Post newspaper to have personally executed 15 Ukrainian prisoners of war. It's believed that Motorola, who did national service with the Russian military, was sent to the DNR to fight after being arrested for joyriding in Rostov in West Russia. Though Motorola wasn't there, his fighters were. They were well-disciplined, well-armed, and very hostile. 2 weeks after I met Motorola's Sparta Battalion, he was killed when a bomb went off in the lift of his apartment block. His head was blown off in the assassination. Many believe Russia got rid of him after he was deemed no longer useful. The DNR claimed Ukrainian guerrillas did it. A young Russian fighter from Volograd took us on a guided tour of the ruined airport. He told me his name was Sergei Lim. He wore a khaki Gorkha suit with the hood up. His face was covered with a scar from the nose down. His body armor was loaded with extra magazines, a radio, a knife, and a tourniquet. I walked through the shell of the airport with him. We passed rusted remains of tanks and APCs, through mounds of rubble and past flights of stairs that had no destination. Everything faded into the grey background of the destruction. Now in his early 20s, Lim claimed to have left his wife and child in Russia to come and fight for the DNR when the war started. At the moment, we have a regular army in the area, he said. There's no militia here anymore. We're a military unit with commanders who give us orders, who provide us with weapons. Which military are you talking about? I asked. He paused. Everything is official now, he replied. We, the DNR, have an army corps. For the sake of dodging various international legal issues, both Russia and the separatists were still pretending that the Kremlin was barely involved in the war. Everyone in the DNR, of course, knew that this was bullshit. The Sparta Battalion even had Russian Ural trucks parked up at their makeshift base in the ruins of the airport. Ural trucks are predominantly made for and used by the Russian armed forces. Lim shouted angrily when I tried to take photos of the trucks. On the third floor of what was the new airport terminal before the war, we had to shimmy across a metal support beam that sat over a pit of debris about 15 feet below us. At the height of the war, the separatists had forced Ukraine POWs to dig out the bodies of their dead friends from the rubble in this same area. "The Ukrainians don't bother to collect them," said Lim, but Conan and Rangeloni were grinning. We left the Sparta battalion at the airport and pressed on to a front line in Zaitseva. Here, the separatists had dug deep trenches. The fighters were ragtag, young and disorganized. Some wore tracksuits, some wore fatigues. They sat around picking at the dirt walls of their positions and chain smoking. Their commander called himself Iron Man, because my body is so full of shrapnel it sets the metal detector off at the airport. Poking his head from a position, Iron Man looked through a pair of binoculars. "The Ukrainians will start firing soon," he said. "Their positions are about 300 meters away." He handed the binoculars to Rangeloni, who was no longer wearing the flak jacket or helmet he'd been wearing at Donetsk airport. After 15 minutes in the trenches, gunfire cracked in the near distance. Then the hollow boom of mortars. We all ducked. "See, we don't fire back," Iron Man said. "All our rifles are covered in oil because we don't use them." While both sides are guilty of constantly breaking the ceasefire, OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, an organization that monitors the Donbass region, reports that most of the violations are started by the DNR. The gunfire grew closer, loud cracks above our heads. "It's them," Iron Man said. "They're just trying to provoke us." We ran from the trenches to an abandoned school used by separatists as a makeshift base. During our 30 minutes pinned down in the school, roughly a dozen DNR militants took shelter there. None of them returned fire. No one seemed particularly bothered. Scrawled on a blackboard in chalk, someone had written, "Ukrainians are faggots." With gunfire going off outside, Iron Man rested his rifle on the lid of an old piano and began to play a tune. Everyone laughed and clapped, especially Rangeloni. On returning to the UK, I showed footage of the skirmish in Zaitseva to open source investigators from the citizen journalism collective Bellingcat. It all felt fishy. The whole thing seemed orchestrated like the rest of the press tour. Bellingcat has contributed to exposing Russia's involvement in the Ukraine conflict from the start, playing a key role in the MH17 investigation. They checked the coordinates of the trenches we'd been in and positions of the Ukrainian lines. They said it was possible that these separatists were actually facing their own positions while claiming the Ukrainian army was firing on them. What's more, in exactly the same spot outside the school, France 24 News recently caught the separatists on camera saying they would dress up in Ukrainian uniforms to fool the press. It seems likely that not only did the DNR minders set up orchestrated interviews with civilians, but also faked the gunfight. The separatists aligned with the DNR present themselves as freedom fighters. And whilst it's true there's some level of support for them, they never provided the chance to see that authentically. Everything was set up, and the people running the tour weren't very good at hiding it. There are mounds of evidence that the DNR is militarily assisted by Russia. Many Russian soldiers have been found fighting there just without their uniforms, and tanks and heavy artillery has been seen crossing the border. There are also allegations from Amnesty International and the UN that the DNR has committed war crimes such as torture and extrajudicial killing. They're also very clearly limiting freedom of speech. In my time spent in the DNR, it was never quite apparent what was real and what was just for show. In this respect, the Donetsk People's Republic feels less like liberated land and more like a state being pulled violently behind an iron curtain.
Scotland Dole Queue, Syria Frontline. Why a young man from Dundee went to fight ISIS. 2018. After travelling through the mountains of northern Iraq in the back of a Hilux pickup truck, a young Scottish man from Dundee waited with Kurdish guerrillas for a night with no moon. They needed complete darkness to avoid being spotted as they smuggled themselves across the border into Syria. Knelt down in the dirt on the bank of the Tigris River,
They watched silently as armed patrol boats cruised past into the night. It was the spring of 2016 and the start of the fifth year of the Syrian Civil War. The young Scotsman, an unemployed 27-year-old named Callum Ross, had travelled 3,000 miles from a council estate in Edinburgh to be there. When the coast was clear, the guerrillas scrambled down the riverbank and inflated a rubber dinghy in the water. Nervous but excited, Callum leapt in. He sailed slowly into the darkness. A few tense minutes passed. The patrol boat could be heard in the distance. What if it spotted him? What if they opened fire? Finally, the dinghy reached the other side of the Tigris. A second unit of guerrillas were waiting for Callum in the field next to the river. This was his last chance to turn back, either go home to his flat in Scotland or be escorted to a training camp in Syria. The young Scotsman, covered head to toe in tattoos with a rough ginger beard, had already made up his mind. He got out of the dinghy and pushed it back across the river. Within a month, he'd be on the front lines in Syria with an assault rifle in his hands. Callum Ross had come to fight the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, ISIS. While reports of the 5,000 or so people who have left Europe to fight for ISIS have caused countless headlines and much soul-searching in Britain over recent years, the hundreds of volunteers who have gone to fight against them have received less attention. Callum Ross, one of those volunteers, stayed out there longer than most. One night, as he manned a point at the front line just 30 miles from Raqqa City, the former capital and stronghold of the Islamic State's self-declared caliphate, he joked to me on the phone that the standard of food was about as good as it is in Scotland. He'd just eaten a dinner of knock-off Dairy Lee triangles and pasta before holding up for a night shift behind some sandbags on the roof of an abandoned house. He didn't seem to take himself too seriously, and for a man with no body armour, helmet or boots, he seemed surprisingly happy to be on the front line. Earlier this year, after 12 months at war, Callum returned to Edinburgh where I travelled to spend the weekend with him, hoping to find out how a young man goes from the dole queue in Scotland to the front line in Syria. "I always wanted to go to war," he said, dragging on a roll-up as we sat in a high-rise council block. "But I'm not going to go fight for some queen or fight for the fucking Tories. I fought for something that makes sense to me." In Syria, the foreign volunteers joined the People's Protection Units, the YPG, a Kurdish militia that's been fighting to carve out a state for itself, known as Rojava, in northern Syria since the start of the war in 2011. The mountainous areas between Iraq and Syria are controlled by the YPG's counterpart, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. The PKK fights mostly in Turkey, fighting the Turkish regime for Kurdish rights in what they believe is North Kurdistan, current-day southeast Turkey. The PKK has been fighting since 1984 in a conflict that's claimed more than 40,000 lives. It's listed as a terrorist organisation by Europe and America. Now, officially, the PKK states that the YPG is not its Syrian wing. Any fighter on the ground, though, might tell you something quite different. But with this narrative, the YPG can receive help from the West, and the West can have a strong ally in Syria without helping people they've sanctioned as terrorists. Both the YPG and the PKK have the same figurehead leader, imprisoned Abdullah Öcalan, the same ideology, and sometimes the same fighters, depending which side of the border they're on. But if anyone asks, they're not the same. This is the madness of the Syrian war. With the help of US airstrikes and heavy weaponry, the YPG has proven to be one of the most effective fighting forces battling ISIS. Whilst creating a homeland for themselves in Rojava, the YPG has drawn the attention of leftists all over the world due to their proclaimed ideals. The YPG, despite facing criticism from hyper-capitalist Western think tanks that it's authoritarian, says that it fights for equality and anti-fascism. It's a message that made sense to Callum. "I fucking hate the ISIS ideology. To me, it's the same as Nazism," he said. 100% that was my motivation for going to Syria, to fight fascism. Having been involved in far-left movements for years, Callum says he witnessed the rise of identity politics in Europe and wanted nothing to do with it. He told me he thought left-wing politics in Europe was shite, calling the G20 rioters weekend warriors, and he laughed at how the far left has become preoccupied with being offended. He saw himself as a true working class revolutionary like it used to be. Callum grew up hearing stories about how it used to be. He said his dad would often tell him about the 1936 to 1939 Spanish Civil War, where thousands of workers from across Europe voluntarily went to fight in Spain against the military dictator Francisco Franco. His dad told him about how some of his grandfather's friends had even gone to fight. Eventually, Callum came to see them as heroes. "There's a long history of Scots going over to fight against Franco," Callum said. "Even in my city, there's a commemorative plaque with the names of the volunteers who went. To me, growing up, I always heard a lot of stories about them. They're unsung heroes." Hearing the stories of working class men and women who died fighting fascism in Spain left a deep impression on a young Callum. As he grew older, his politics swung back and forth and were later built on these volunteer fighter stories and the poverty he became surrounded by. Eventually, Callum involved himself with the Antifa scene, scrapping with the far right on the streets of Scotland. "There was plenty of fist fighting," he laughed. "Bottles, knives, I'm Scottish." Callum shrugged and grinned. As he went to protest throughout his early 20s, propaganda videos of YPG foreign volunteers started spreading on Facebook in 2014. When he saw them, Callum immediately drew a comparison between those volunteers and the ones in Spain that he'd been told about as a kid. "I liken the two struggles," he nodded. "They're different wars, but fighting the same ideas." A fire was kindling now inside Callum. Apart from the occasional scrap with a fascist, he felt there was no meaning to his life. The more footage of the YPG fighters he watched, the more protests in Europe seemed inconsequential. It became obvious to Callum. His fight wasn't in Scotland, it was in Syria. Before the night he crossed the Tigris River, Callum was in a training camp on the outskirts of northern Iraq. After being met at the airport, he was driven for hours through the mountains before stepping into a scene unlike anything he'd ever experienced. By the flickering light of a fire, he saw guns propped up against rocks and hardened PKK guerrillas dressed in their traditional baggy fatigues. There was a small stream nearby that people drank from. Fighters from all over the world welcomed him. "That was amazing, just amazing, man," he said. "It was such a beautiful place. I remember looking out over everything, drinking chai and chatting to people from all over the world who were just coming and leaving Syria." Despite this, he said he felt a first twitch of cold feet as he saw the other foreign fighters wander back into the camp. The war had taken its toll on these young men and women. "I remember thinking, wow, you guys look fucked up, you know? You could just see the war in them. I thought, fuck, that's going to be me. It scared me a little bit. But then I thought, oh well, we're here now." In the next 4 weeks, he'd take a crash course in the Kurdish Kamanji language, as well as briefly being shown how to shoot rifles and throw grenades. "In training, you do a very small amount of shooting guns," Callum laughed. "I fired 9 rounds with a Kalashnikov, 3 rounds with a Bixi, a PK machine gun, 3 rounds with a Druganov, a Soviet sniper rifle, and we threw stones instead of grenades to learn. That's the basic Rojava military education." When Callum's training was complete, he was given his own Kalashnikov and a Kurdish name. Callum Ross became Rizgar Derik. His identity as a fighter was born. Soon it would be tested. Rizgar was sent straight to the front line, where he would take part in the famous Night War. Callum joined a small unit under the YPG, made up entirely of foreign volunteers. It was named the International Freedom Battalion, the IFB. The IFB was composed of a mix of hardcore communists and anarchists from all over the world. The shades of red vary on the communist side of things, and there were many anarchist sub-factions within the IFB, but one thing the fighters are united in is their hate for ISIS. For Callum, the IFB would become his new family. One night at a makeshift frontline base near the town of Saluk, just 50 miles north of Raqqa, Callum and a French volunteer were making a cup of tea for their Iranian friend on guard duty. The base was just a few crumbling stucco buildings and a water tower. At the time, heavy fighting had left Saluk a ghost town. Around a dozen IFB were manning the base to ensure ISIS fighters didn't move in to retake any ground in the YPG's now accomplished push to liberate Raqqa. Usually, three people would man the water tower with night vision goggles and thermal scopes. That night, though, it was empty. Earlier, some Kurdish YPG had come to take the group's equipment to use at their own position down the road. Without it, there was no point blindly manning the tower. Instead, Kalam and his unit were on the flat roof of a building where they slept surrounded by sandbags and weapons. As Kalam boiled up a hot cup of sugary chai, the Iranian shouted suddenly. He'd seen someone on the dirt berm just 15 feet away from the base. Kalam bolted for his Kalashnikov. The threat of an ISIS suicide bomber sneaking up on them was high. Everyone leapt into their positions on the roof as they tried to see the enemy. Someone shouts, "There, pap, 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 we all start fucking firing. I'm at the end of one corner of the roof behind a load of sandbags, and I had an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade launcher. Never fired an RPG before, but I'd been given the job as RPG guy," Kalam laughed. "That was my job, so I'm in my wee position, and I've got an RPG, my Kalash, and I was like, right, fuck, this is it." His adrenaline pumped, his heart raced, it was his first battle. The Scotsman was a long way from home. Kalam knelt down behind the sandbags with his rifle, chambered a round, raised his head, had a look, raised the gun, took one shot, took another, then jammed. "My fucking gun jammed," Kalam burst out laughing as he told me the story. Luckily, he'd slept next to a Serb at the training camp who claimed to have once fought in the French Foreign Legion. The Serb had shown Kalam how to speed assemble a rifle blindfolded every morning. In roughly a minute, Kalam had dislodged the jammed round from his weapon and was back shooting into the blackness. Then, suddenly, as he fired one way, two bullets whizzed right past his head from the other. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the muzzle flashes coming from the water tower that we'd left empty behind us. Kalam shouted for his team commander, summoning him over to his position. The French commander scrambled to cover the Scotsman. Kalam explained that ISIS had snuck past them into the water tower. In this strong French accent, he just goes, "Oh shit, if they are in the tower, we are really fucked now." The foreign volunteers were helpless. They hugged the ground and waited. After a minute or so, the sound of constant outgoing gunfire was broken by the static of the radios across the roof. Slowly, the guns stopped firing. Everybody stood up. Kalam and the Frenchman, stretched out on their stomachs still, looked at each other puzzled. Kurdish could be heard crackling from the radios. The YPG fighters nearby called to ask us, "What are you guys shooting at?" And we're like, "We don't know, you guys have got the night vision, what are you shooting at?" They never answered that question. Kalam grinned. Turns out the YPG sniper unit down the road had heard the commotion and quietly ran to the foreigner's base to help. They shimmied up the water tower and took aim. That worried me a bit, because they were in the tower with thermal vision shooting at me. In that moment, everybody got confused. So there was nobody there. There was no ISIS. We were shooting at nothing. So that became the famous night war. The event became a standing joke amongst the group. But privately, Kalam was forced to reflect on the fact his life had almost ended in friendly fire in his first ever gunfight. The false alarm turned out to be merely a taste of what was to come. Plenty of people would claim to feel as passionately as Kalam about opposing ISIS and fascism, but very few would board a plane to risk their lives for it. In Edinburgh, I tried to get him to explain what made him different. Kalam looked out the window at the other grey columns of flats that made up the estate. They were like giant tombstones. They stood there across the green staring back at him. "People are ruined out here," he said solemnly. "You have to shoplift to fucking live." Whilst unemployment in Scotland isn't that much higher than in England, rates vary massively in different areas. In Dundee, for example, where Kalam grew up, youth unemployment is at a rate of 19.4%. The national average in Scotland is 14.3%. Some poor areas are noticeably poorer than others, something Kalam knows all about. Struggling to find full-time employment, he'd do labouring here and there while signing on for benefits, living on about £300 a month. With no work, no real excitement, no future, Kalam spent his time smoking too much weed and getting tattooed by his mates. His arms are a tapestry of inked gypsy girls, mum and dad love hearts, and a creepy plague doctor. A baseball cap stays permanently attached to his head. As we walked through the estate, there was a quiet confidence to Callum. He doesn't seem one to get accosted. He's tall, broad, and as he put it, looks like a right dodgy geezer. Callum said he grew up around crazies and junkies in Dundee before wasting away on the housing estates of Edinburgh. There's an actual sense of community in these places, he shrugged. I prefer it to the more affluent areas. Nevertheless, he said, he felt he had fuck all to live for in Scotland and, after researching Kurdistan for 3 years, took the plunge and arranged his travel to Syria via various now-defunct Facebook groups ran by the YPG. The night before I left, I was sitting exactly where we are in this flat, he said. I was with all my mates. We ate food, had some beers, got stoned, had a laugh. After the going away party, Callum gave a key to one of his friends. I asked her to take some sentimental stuff out of my house that I wanted to keep for if I made it home. That was my mindset. I'm never coming back here. I was scared, but I was so focused on Rojava, in my mind it was like I was already there. He put some clothes in an old tattered rucksack he'd had since he was 13 years old. It'd been a gift from his mum. He still had it. In the lining, Callum Ross was scrawled in permanent marker. He packed 2 pairs of underwear, 2 pairs of socks, 2 t-shirts, a hoodie, and a book, a copy of Orhan Pamuk's Snow. He left everything else behind. The famous night war would be Callum's first and last taste of accidental combat. In the following months, he snuck behind ISIS lines to lay bombs on the roads, helped to fight around the Yazidis' Mount Sinjar in Iraq, and even witnessed the West helping hand in action when an American A-10 Warthog fighter jet strafed ISIS positions. Callum described how YPG commanders would radio them at random and give just an hour's notice before they had to embark on a mission. Despite the high risk of getting captured and beheaded, or burned alive, or drowned, or shot by a child, or thrown off a building, or any of the other horrific executions ISIS fighters have filmed themselves carrying out, Callum never questioned these snap operations. You just say, yeah, okay, Callum shrugged. Then you just walk into ISIS territory. You leave your front and walk to their front. One time, when some comrades came to pick me up, the back of the car was piled up with all sorts of material for making bombs. Both of the comrades turned round at the same time and said, no smoking. Callum laughed. I was like, yeah, no worries, mate. The day he witnessed an American fighter jet was the first time Callum prayed at war. He's not religious, but as the red streaks of tracer rounds flew past his head for hours, he got desperate. That was scary, he said. I prayed a lot. Just in those moments, I was like, God, will you just fucking sort me out? Callum and other IFB fighters had been guarding a deserted village 50 kilometres from Raqqa. It'd been empty for weeks. Then, one day at 2 o'clock in the morning, the silence was shattered as the call of Allahu Akbar echoed across the village from the mosque's loudspeaker. It was an ISIS imam. The jihadists had gotten back into the village. They were coming. Almost immediately, Callum found himself diving for cover behind oil drums full of sand. ISIS was attacking from 3 different directions, pumping tracer fire at him and the other fighters. I just started shooting at ISIS from there for hours, he said. It was the most intense battle I was involved in. The fighting continued all night until coalition warplanes flew over. When the sunrise came, the A-10 arrived. When that shit comes, it's like a demon. The noise it makes. It's like Satan has just flown past spitting out death. Callum's prayers had been answered. The battle ended with the scattered corpses of ISIS fighters spread out all around his position. Severed legs, arms, torn up intestines, an eyeball. It was a sight he'd grow accustomed to in the months he had left. In the end, it wasn't the horrors of war that convinced Callum to leave Syria, though. Instead, he says it was the new foreign volunteers who joined them from the West that broke his spirit. After a year, he'd learned Kurdish so well that he was often asked to translate between them, the new volunteers, and the Kurdish fighters. Towards the end, I was having to deal with a lot of the other volunteers' problems, Callum sighed. That got me tired. I hated being with a lot of the other internationals. I've got no time for someone who comes to join the 6th year of the Syrian war to complain that things aren't good. What the fuck were you expecting? When Callum arrived back in Scotland, he was picked up at the airport by special police dressed in suits. They asked to see his passport and escorted him into a side office. We went into a room and I said, I'm not answering anything until I get an iron brew. They laughed and I just looked at them. They were like, ah, he's fucking being serious. So they got some guy to go to Marks and Spencer's to get me an iron brew on police expenses. I sat there with my iron brew and they questioned me for a few hours. Then they let me go. Shortly after we returned, Callum learned that several of the people he'd come to call friends had been killed back in Syria. I asked if he thought he'd perhaps come home at the right moment. I don't know, he shrugged. I don't know. For the first time, Callum seemed down. He walked into the kitchen to light another roll-up using the toaster. He'd no lighter. When he walked back in, he stared out the window for a minute. It was dark now. I'm now back in the flat I was in the night before I left, he said. It feels weird. It feels strange. Fighting in Syria changed my life. I found purpose, a reason to live. Nothing's changed here, you know. You can just come back here and slot directly back into what you were doing, which I don't want to do. I want to fucking do something with myself. As he said this, the pop, pop, pop of fireworks sounded from somewhere outside. Straight away, Callum was on his feet and by the window. Incoming, he shouted. Allahu Akbar. Then he looked back at me, imaginary rifle still at his shoulder, and he laughed.
Fear and death in North Kurdistan. Turkish soldiers killing Kurdish kids. 2015. On January 6, 2015, a 14-year-old Kurdish boy was shot dead by Turkish special forces in the town of Cizre, southeast Turkey. Umit Kurt was killed as he walked home from his job as a painter and decorator at around 5 p.m. He was passing through an area previously controlled by the Patriotic Revolutionary Youth Movement, the YDGH, the youth wing of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. The PKK being Turkey's largest and most militant Kurdish resistance movement. The neighbourhood in Cizre had just been opened up after a peace agreement was made with the local police and a PKK order to stand down. The YDGH has been acting as a rebel paramilitary force in Cizre for the last few months. With armed checkpoints and patrols, they'd taken full control of several neighbourhoods. I went to Cizre to find out what was going on. The YDGH's members, mostly in their teens and early 20s, told me they were doing this to protect their streets after gun battles broke out in December between them, the police, and a jihadist group known as the Hudapa. After several days of intense fighting, the YDGH agreed to put down their weapons on January the 6th and allow the roads into the neighbourhoods to be unblocked. The day the YDGH stood down, however, the authorities moved in. Police water cannon trucks and military APCs pushed into the Judi area of Cizre. The Turkish special forces opened fire. Three people were wounded and Umit Kurt was killed. A recent Human Rights Bar Association report stated that the attack on the 14-year-old was specifically targeted. Umit Kurt was unarmed and, according to locals I spoke to, was not a member of the YDGH or any other armed groups. I went to speak to Umit Kurt's family 5 days after his death. Inside the modest family home in one of Cizre's many impoverished neighbourhoods, uncles, cousins, and Umit's elder brother sat on the front room floor in mournful silence. Abdullah Kurt, Umit's father, walked in clutching a framed picture of his boy. We shook hands and he smiled. Stoic as he was, the pain showed clearly in his eyes. Umit was a very good son, Abdullah said. He would come into the room even if there were 20 people in here and he'd say Assalamu Alaikum to everyone. People liked him more than me. He was so funny. Umit was shot with a single bullet. It entered through his back and passed straight through his heart. I asked Abdullah how he felt when he saw his young son in the morgue. It's a very hard feeling when you see your son growing up in front of your eyes, being good to his father and mother, and then suddenly he's been killed. He paused and looked down at the picture. We lost Umit's body, but his soul is still with us. It's been reported that a police investigation into Umit's killing will be held in secret. I asked Abdullah if he felt the Turkish government would bring justice for his family. His sadness turned quickly to anger. The only justice for my son
is that what happened to Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi happens to the Turkish president Erdogan. Abdullah's animosity toward the Turkish state is of course understandable. His thoughts are also shared by all of the people that I spoke to in Cizre. Many in this small town, just 5 miles from Syria, feel that Erdogan's new Turkey model is targeting the Kurds specifically. The 14 million Kurds living in Turkey have endured a history of brutal oppression at the hands of successive national governments. Yet, in some ways, Erdogan's treatment of the minority has actually been an improvement when compared to previous Turkish leaders. He's eased off on banning the Kurdish language and has at least negotiated with the PKK. This article was written before Erdogan's government transformed into the brutal totalitarian regime it's now become. That's not to say he's the harbinger of equality, though. Unemployment in Kurdish areas is nearly twice the national average, and Erdogan's government has recently arrested journalists and students for criticising his ruling right-wing AKP party. To make matters worse, when the battle for Kobani between Kurdish forces and Islamic State militants broke out in September 2014, Erdogan chose not to help the Kurdish forces on his border. Instead, he bombed PKK fighters on the border with Iraq, claiming they'd attacked Turkish troops. Tension among the Kurds in Turkey can be felt all throughout the south of the country, though the situation in Cizre is especially fragile. At least 5 Kurds, all under the age of 20, have been shot dead in the streets in the last 2 weeks. This hardly legitimizes the notion of a peace agreement in this tight-knit community. The bloodshed is one reason why many people seem so in favour of having armed teenagers patrolling their streets at night and not the police. One thing Abdullah was adamant about was that his son was by no means involved with the YDGH. Yet he refused to condemn the group, even when I mentioned that if they hadn't been in the neighbourhood, then the police might not have come in with their guns in the first place. Abdullah insisted that the YDGH were needed for protection. They were popular amongst the people. The future of the Kurds will be decided by the Kurds, he said, before leading me into the next room. Inside, Umit Kurt's mother, Nafia, was sat down on her son's bed. His childhood teddy bear was still propped up in the corner. Umit had laid here only 5 days ago. Now he was in a grave. Nafia was distraught. When the Turkish state sees a child on the street, they simply fire and leave them on the road, she said. My lovely young boy, what was his crime? What was the reason? I sat down next to her as she spoke in a whisper while cradling a picture of her son. She told me about the day he was killed. The Turkish special forces just stopped and aimed at him. Someone came to my door, a child. He said Umit is injured and in hospital. I said that Umit had been at work. Where would he get injured? The boy told me my son had been shot. I went to the hospital, and when I saw my son, it was like the world had ended. I uncovered his face. His injury was in his chest, his heart. The bullet had exited through his heart. My sweetheart was lying there. I couldn't believe my son was killed. Umit Kurt was likely dead before he even got to the hospital. I wish to God for no one else to go through what I went through, Nafir continued. May God demand answers for his tragedy from the Turkish state. I'll look for justice as long as I'm alive. I just want to know why. He was just a worker. We're poor. We're just tenants. I asked Nafia if she had any reason to believe that Umit was a part of the YDGH. My son was a good boy, she replied. He had nothing to do with the YDGH. The grieving mother said she believes the Turkish state will claim her son was a militant to deflect blame for his death. Weeks later, they did. The killing was unjust, but the state is big and we are small, Nafia added. What can we do but set ourselves on fire? Sometimes I feel to set myself on fire in this house. When we finished speaking, Nafia kissed the picture of Umit and began to weep. The family came in to comfort her. It was heartbreaking. Her youngest son had been shot dead in the street. After speaking with Umit Kurt's family, I wanted to see where he'd been shot. It turned out that a member of the YDGH had been present on the day that he was killed, albeit in his civilian clothes, not the fatigues he wears for the 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. night shifts on Jizra's 12 YDGH checkpoints. "I saw it all," he told me. "I can take you there." We drove to a nearby checkpoint. Two masked young men approached. They held assault rifles and wore green fatigues similar to those worn by the YPG, the PKK-affiliated People's Protection Units, who are fighting a few miles away across the border in Syria. "This checkpoint is called Umit Kurt," one of the armed men told me as we shook hands. "Umit Kurt worked around here. He was a painter and decorator. We weren't aware that anything was about to happen. The street opened and the enemy, the Turkish Special Forces, entered. When the enemy approached, our martyred friend Umit Kurt came out onto the street. He didn't know the enemy was there, so he started to walk home. The enemy were over there next to that white car. The militant struggled with his rifle as he pointed out with one hand where the government forces had been when they opened fire. Our friend went to run this way and they started shooting. He went that way trying to get home. He was martyred over there." The young militant led me a few yards away to a lamppost, the spot where young Umit died. On the wall to the right was a spray-painted stencil of PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan. "A bullet hit him here and he fell to the ground. The enemy, our oppressor, shot him. It was the special forces." By now, a large crowd of children and teenagers had gathered. They all knew about Umit's death, and none of them seemed intimidated by the two men dressed in fatigues, brandishing assault rifles in the middle of the street in what was still pretty much daylight. "The people are behind us. They appreciate what we're doing," said the militant. "We are not terrorists. We are PKK. We're guerrillas. We're protecting our people. We're demanding our land. This is Jizra. This is Kurdistan. Let the Turkish state know that we opened the roads when our leader told us to, and they shot a child." The day after I left Jizra, on January 12th, another child was shot dead by Turkish security forces. This time it was Nihat Kazanan. Reports are conflicting, but eyewitnesses state that police moved into the Yafez area, also where Umit was killed, and began firing. Nihat Kazanan was hit in the head and died that day in hospital. There's a video of one of Nihat's young friends running with his lifeless body just after he'd been shot. Jizra's Kurds blame the shooting on the authorities, or the police in their autopsy report blame the YDGH. They state that the round found in Nihat's head was a plastic shotgun shell, which is not used by the police, but often found with armed groups. Despite the fact that the video shows police right near to where Nihat was killed, the police insist that they weren't even in the area at the time. Later, an investigation proved that Nihat, an unarmed 12-year-old Kurdish boy, was in fact shot dead by the Turkish police. Whilst with the YDGH, I witnessed them use their guns only once. I was embedded with them during a clash with riot police and special forces. The young Kurdish militants returned fire after the special forces fired shots in our direction. The last time I saw police use their guns was when they fired tracer rounds into the sky on the day that the checkpoint stood down for a second time, on Öcalan's direct orders. The PKK leader released a written statement from his prison cell calling for calm. I was there in Jizra that day. A young boy, maybe 10 years old, came up to me pointing at the tracer rounds that the Turkish police were continuously firing into the air in the distance. "Kalashnikov," he said excitedly. "Turkish provocation." Within a few months, Jizra would become an all-out war zone.
3D printed guns are forever. The network bringing plastic guns to the world. 2019. A new network of 3D printed gun advocates is growing in America, and this time things are different. Unlike previous attempts to popularize 3D printed guns, this operation is entirely decentralized. There's no headquarters, no trademarks, and no real leader. The people behind it reckon that this means they can't be stopped by any government anywhere. If they, the government, were to come after me, they'd first have to find my identity, says Ivan the Troll, a member of the group. I'm one of many, many like-minded individuals who are doing this sort of work.
known only by his online moniker, Ivan the Troll is the de facto spokesman of an underground wave of 3D printing gunsmiths. Ivan says he knows of at least 100 people who are actively developing 3D printed gun technology, and he claims there are thousands taking part in the network. This loose-knit community spans across the whole world. They communicate across several different digital platforms, including Signal, Twitter, IRC, and Discord. They critique each other's work, exchange 3D gun CAD files, offer advice, talk theory, and collaborate on future blueprints. These 3D printed gun enthusiasts, who share similar ideas and political viewpoints on gun control, mostly found each other online via gun control subreddits and forums. Ivan is just one small part of this network. He says he's from Illinois and is of college age, but otherwise he remains mostly anonymous to lie low. At the same time though, he's launched bombastic PR videos demonstrating the new 3D printed gun parts he's created in his garage, including a Glock 17 handgun frame. One of his most recent videos shows the polymer Glock 17 frame in various stages of production in his workshop. The footage is set to fast-paced synthwave music and is run through a trendy VHS filter. The aesthetics are important. Toward the end, Ivan fires several rounds with the fully built handgun as text flashes up saying, "Anyone can make it, live free or die," and "Go ahead, try to stop this, you filthy statists." He's also uploaded the complete CAD reference model designs for a 3D printed AR-15 assault rifle to his file sharing space online. It's clear Ivan is trying to provoke his detractors as much as possible. In February of this year, Ivan and his group decided to name themselves the Terence Dispensed, which is a tongue-in-cheek nod to the notorious Defense Distributed, a 3D printed gun company formerly run by Texan crypto anarchist Cody Wilson. In September 2018, Wilson, 30, was arrested and charged with sexual assault against a minor. He is alleged to have paid $500 to have sex with a 16-year-old girl in his home city of Austin, Texas. Needless to say, this arrest effectively took Wilson out of the 3D printed gun world entirely. Many of the people who looked up to him were either disgusted or realized that his time was up. He stepped down from Defense Distributed, which was before seen as the driving force behind 3D printed guns since it launched in 2012. Wilson was released on a $150,000 bail. He's remained silent since. Defense Distributed has many other ongoing legal battles. Attorney generals from more than 20 US states are currently in the process of suing the company, which has countersued, in a bid to reverse a court win that momentarily allowed Defense Distributed to upload and share 3D printed gun blueprints online. Their headaches are long, drawn out and ongoing. For Ivan's group, the Terence Dispensed, none of this is relevant. They're uploading files individually on services such as Speech, a media hosting site underpinned by the Library blockchain network. They aren't waiting for anyone to give them permission. They've made their own 3D printed gun designs, modified old ones, and are keeping all the Defense Distributed ones available for free too. "Even if there was no government telling me I couldn't do this, I think I would still do it," Ivan says. "Some people get a kick out of video games. I like spending hours and hours drawing stuff on CAD." Ivan isn't just drawing stuff on CAD though. He's providing free files to help anyone with a half-decent FDM, a fused deposition modeling, 3D printer, and some hand tools to make a workable handgun. Once the CAD file is downloaded, it's opened in a slicer program that translates the CAD files into instructions that the 3D printer can understand. Once the 3D printed gun parts are ready, they can be assembled into a fully workable gun. The CAD gun designs put out by Deterrence Dispensed are so well made, according to Ivan, that they're not just workable, but superior. Our AR-15 CAD model is the best in the public domain without a doubt, says Ivan. Despite being overtly antagonistic, Ivan has had no real runnings with the authorities so far. His Twitter account was permanently suspended after New Jersey State Senator Bob Menendez lobbied for it to be taken down. But as far as the government and law enforcement goes, things have been mostly quiet. Ivan sees himself and other radical 3D printed gun groups, such as FOSCAD, another decentralized group of 3D printing enthusiasts who focus on firearms, simply as hobbyists who've chosen the wrong thing to build. He sees 3D printed guns as somewhat of a paper tiger. He points out that while 3D printed gun parts can be built to kill people, zip guns, homemade firearms built from crude materials, have been around for decades and are arguably more deadly. The hysteria and backlash, to Ivan at least, is completely misplaced. Take it from me as someone who's printed a gun. Making a slam fire shotgun is 100 times easier, 100 times quicker, and about 100 times cheaper than printing a regular gun. For $8, I can pop down to Home Depot and build a shotgun. Already in 2019, 156 people have been killed in US mass shootings, and gun-related deaths are at a 20-year high. In March, a far-right militant armed with two semi-automatic rifles and two shotguns killed 51 people in an anti-Muslim attack in Christchurch, New Zealand. In such circumstances, do the US and the world really need more guns, zip gun, 3D printed or otherwise? Ivan thinks yes. The cops killed more people alone last year than all active shooter incidents in the last 10 years, he says. We live in a society in America where you run the risk of a cop blowing your ass up for no specific reason. You don't even have to present a threat to them. A cop can kill you and get away with it just because he really wanted to. He then went on to cite the many police shootings of unarmed black men in America, specifically mentioning Stephon Clark. Clark, 22, was shot to death by police in his own back garden while holding nothing but a mobile phone. I believe it is inherently important that you should be able to own a gun, Ivan continued. You should be able to own the same legal force that the cops are using to control you. But the facts are clear. The majority of gun deaths around the world come from just six countries, one of which is the US. Analysis from Harvard University suggests that where there are more guns, more murders happen. Anti-gun campaigners obviously disagree with the notion of a downloadable gun. Avery Gardner, the co-president of the Brady campaign, has said 3D printed guns present a supreme threat to our safety and security. Speaking after a court decision in August, Gardner said, "Already there have been a wave of dangerous actors seeking to illegally post the blueprints online. A mix of libertarian attitudes and the rewarding hobby aspects of designing and creating something is often what drives members of these decentralized 3D printed gun networks to do what they do. That is, uploading schematics, sharing them, improving designs, and making 3D printed gun work more easily accessible while remaining largely under the radar." Ivan claims he does this for a love of freedom and a radical belief in the US First and Second Amendments, free speech and the right to bear arms. He takes this to such a radical degree, though, that he even theorizes he should technically be able to have his own Tomahawk missiles, saying that they would be safer in his hands than in those of the US military and its allies, given the country's track record for accidentally targeting civilians, including a wedding party in Afghanistan and a school bus in Yemen. referring to the mounting list of civilian killings carried out by US forces in foreign wars, Ivan sounds at times more like a radical leftist than the right-wing gun nut many in America label him as. He claims not to have any specific ideology, though, saying, "I get to be my own special snowflake." As of now, Ivan the Troll, the Terrence Dispensed, and the thousands many more 3D printed gun enthusiasts connected to each other worldwide have essentially let the cat out the bag. They're right in that there is no way to stop the anonymous file sharing of 3D printed guns online. Whether they're just pretending to be doing this for reasons of liberty or otherwise, their message is clear. It's already too late to stop us.
In Search of a Neo-Nazi Murderer, The Beginning of the End for Atomwaffen Division, 2018. Note, this article and the one following it were co-written between myself and two other journalists, Ali Winston and AC Thompson. These two pieces are part of a series of investigative works we did as a team for ProPublica and PBS Frontline. Myself and Ali did the majority of the investigative reporting. A California man accused of killing a 19-year-old University of Pennsylvania student earlier this month is an avowed neo-Nazi and a member of one of the most notorious extremist groups in America, according to three people with knowledge of the man's recent activities. The man, Samuel Woodward, has been charged in Orange County, California, with murdering Blaze Bernstein, who went missing in early January while visiting his family over winter break. Prosecutors allege that Woodward stabbed Bernstein more than 20 times before burying his body in an Orange County park where it was eventually discovered. The two men had attended high school together. Woodward, 20, is set to be arraigned on February 2nd. He has not yet entered a plea. Orange County prosecutors say they're examining the possibility that the killing was a hate crime. Bernstein was Jewish and openly gay. Recent news reports have suggested that the alleged killer might hold far-right or white supremacist political beliefs. Now, though, three people with detailed knowledge of Woodward's recent past have been able to shed more light on the young man's extremist activities. They said Woodward was a member of the Atomwaffen Division, an armed fascist group with the ultimate aim of overthrowing the US government through the use of terrorism and guerrilla warfare. The organization, which celebrates Hitler and Charles Manson as heroes, has been tied to four other murders and an elaborate bomb plot over the past 8 months. Experts who study right-wing US extremist movements believe Atomwaffen's commitment to violence has made it one of the more dangerous groups to emerge from the new wave of white supremacists. Two of the three people who described Woodward's affiliations are friends of his. The other is a former member of Atomwaffen Division. Our investigation into revelations about Woodward's background add a new element to a murder case that has attracted considerable local and national news coverage in the US. It also raises fresh concerns about groups like Atomwaffen Division, well-armed cells of uncertain size that appear very capable of genuine harm. The former Atomwaffen member told us that Woodward joined the organization in early 2016. He later traveled to Texas to attend Atomwaffen meetings and a 3-day training camp, which involved instruction in firearms, hand-to-hand combat, camping, and survival skills. We've obtained photographs of Woodward at an outdoor Atomwaffen meeting in the scrubby Texas countryside. One of the photos depicts Woodward and other members doing Nazi salutes whilst wearing half-skull masks. In other pictures at the same spot, presumably taken at the same moment by the looks of it, Woodward is unmasked and easily identifiable.
The young man is proficient with both handguns and assault rifles, according to one person who participated in the Texas training and watched him shoot. This person also said that Woodward helped organize a number of Atomwaffen members in California. Social media posts and chat logs I obtained from Woodward's friends show that he openly described himself as a national socialist, a Nazi. He was as anti-Semitic as you can get, according to one of his acquaintances. We contacted Orange County prosecutors regarding Woodward's alleged neo-Nazi activities. Michelle van der Linden, a spokesperson for the district attorney's office, said she couldn't comment directly on the case, but said the investigation is ongoing, with detectives exploring all possible leads. Woodward told police Bernstein had tried to kiss him while they were in the park, according to a sealed affidavit obtained by the Orange County Register. Woodward's defense lawyer, Edward Munoz, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. On Wednesday, Bernstein's parents spoke to reporters about the loss of their son, but said they were not interested in talking about any information they had on the investigation into his death. The Los Angeles Times quoted his mother, Jean Pepper Bernstein, as saying she had worried during her son's life that he might be a target because he was Jewish and gay. It was concerning sending him out into the big world, she said, but at some point you have to let go and they leave the nest and fly. I couldn't protect him from everything. Atomwaffen formed properly in 2015. It's estimated to have about 80 members scattered around the country in small cells. The former member we're speaking to said the group's ranks have grown since the lethal and chaotic alt-right Unite the Right rally last summer in Charlottesville, Virginia. Whilst many of the new white extremist groups that attended the rally have consciously avoided using Nazi imagery, Atomwaffen has done the complete opposite. They're bombastic with their fascism. The name can be translated to Atomic Weapons Division in German, and the organization embraces Third Reich iconography, including swastikas, the Totenkopf, and SS lightning bolts. The group frequently produces YouTube videos featuring masked Atomwaffen members hiking through the backcountry to then mag-dumping rifles into the distance. They've also filmed themselves burning the US Constitution and setting fire to the American flag at an Atomwaffen event that they called the Doomsday Hate Camp. Atomwaffen's biggest inspiration seems to be James Mason, a longtime US fascist who belonged to the American Nazi Party and later, during the 1970s, joined a more militant offshoot. During the 1980s, Mason published a newsletter called Siege, in which he advocated for shunning political collective activism in favor of creating a new fascist regime through murder, small lone wolf terror attacks, and eventually all-out war against the government. Mason also struck up a friendship with the bloodthirsty cult leader Charles Manson. Charles Manson has become another hero for Atomwaffen, who Photoshop his face and quotes into their propaganda. The organization first gained a measure of national attention in May of 2017 when one of its members executed two other members. The gunman was 18-year-old Devin Arthurs, one of Atomwaffen's founding members. He's been charged in a state court in Tampa, Florida, with murdering the two other members, Andrew Wunschuk, 18, and Jeremy Himmelman, 22. Both of the deceased were Atomwaffen loyalists and avowed neo-Nazis. The murders allegedly occurred after Arthurs swapped his militant Nazism ideology for militant jihadism. When police took Arthurs into custody, according to news accounts based on police reports, he claimed he had shot his former comrades because they had taunted him about his Muslim faith. He said they were plotting violent attacks to further their fascist agenda. Arthurs told investigators he killed Wunschuk and Himmelman because they want to build a Fourth Reich. While Arthurs initially confessed to the killings, he has pleaded not guilty. The case is ongoing. When law enforcement searched the apartment in Tampa, Florida, where Arthurs and the others lived, they found firearms, a framed photograph of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, rifles, ammunition, and a cooler full of the highly volatile explosive compound hexamethylene trioxide diamine, HMTD. Investigators also discovered radioactive material in the home. The bomb-making material belonged to a fourth roommate, the Atomwaffen founder and head leader, Brandon Russell. Russell was a Florida National Guardsman. Arthurs told authorities that Russell had been planning to blow up a nuclear power plant near Miami. Earlier this month, Russell pleaded guilty in a federal district court in Tampa to illegal possession of explosives. He was sentenced to just 5 years in federal prison. Atomwaffen surfaced again in connection with a double homicide in Reston, Virginia in December 2017. A 17-year-old neo-Nazi shot to death his girlfriend's parents, Buckley Kuhn Freaker and Scott Freaker. They had just urged their daughter to break up with him. The accused shot himself in the head afterwards, but survived. He remains hospitalized. He was charged as a juvenile in state court in Virginia with two counts of homicide. The 17-year-old was a big fan of Atomwaffen and James Mason, according to his posts on social media. The former Atomwaffen member we've been speaking to said that the teen was in direct communication with the group.
Atomwaffen down, exposing America's new Nazi terror threat, 2018. Late last month, we reported that Sam Woodward, the man accused of killing gay Jewish student Blaze Bernstein, was an avowed neo-Nazi and a member of Atomwaffen Division, one of America's most militant extremist groups. The news spread quickly across the world after it hit the media. Woodward was accused of fatally stabbing 19-year-old Blaze Bernstein and burying his body in an Orange County park in California. The report, it turns out, was also shared enthusiastically in the secretive online chats conducted by members of Atomwaffen Division. "I love this," one member wrote of the killing, according to copies of the online chats we managed to get hold of. Another called Woodward a, quote, "one-man gay Jew wrecking crew." Other members joined in. "What I really want to know is, who leaked that shit about Sam to the media?" a third member wrote. "Rats and traitors get the rope first," said another. "We've obtained secret Atomwaffen chat logs, some 250,000 messages spanning more than 6 months from their internal servers. These messages offer a rare window into Atomwaffen Division that goes well beyond what has surfaced elsewhere about a group whose members have been implicated in a string of violent crimes. Atomwaffen Division uses Discord, an online chat service designed for video gamers to engage in online discussions. In a matter of months, people associated with the group, including Woodward, have been charged in 5 murders. The group's leader pleaded guilty to possession of explosives after authorities uncovered a possible plot to blow up a nuclear facility near Miami. Whilst putting several propaganda videos online, by and large, Atomwaffen cloaks its operations in secrecy and bars members from speaking to the media. The chat logs and other material we've obtained provide unusually extensive information about the group's leaders, wider makeup, and potential targets. We've learned a lot whilst trawling the messages. The group may have as many as 20 cells around the country. Small groups of indeterminate size in Texas, Virginia, Washington, Nevada, and elsewhere. Members armed with assault rifles and other guns have taken part in weapons training in various locations over the last 2 years, including last month in the Nevada desert near Death Valley. Members have discussed using explosives to cripple public water systems and destroy parts of the electrical power grid. One member even claimed to have obtained classified maps of the power grid in California.
Throughout the chats, Atomoff remembers Lord Timothy McVeigh, the former soldier who bombed the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995, killing 168, including numerous children. They also praise the white supremacist Charleston church shooter Dylan Roof, who shot 9 people dead in 2015, and even Anders Breivik, the Norwegian far-right extremist who massacred 77 people in 2011. What's also interesting is that Sam Woodward posted several messages in the days after Blaze Bernstein's murder. This was before he was arrested and charged. In one thread, he told his fellow Atomwaffen members that he was thinking about the passing of life and was truly grateful for our time together. Woodward, 20, has pleaded not guilty in the Bernstein case. Prosecutors have said they're exploring whether the murder constituted a hate crime or not. Detectives are now investigating what role, if any, Atomwaffen might have played in the homicide. Sam Woodward and Blaze Bernstein had known each other in high school in California and appear to have reconnected somehow shortly before the killing. We've managed to firmly identify 5 key Atomwaffen members through information provided by law enforcement investigators, internal Atomwaffen records, outside experts, and a former Atomwaffen member. It's now clear that John Cameron Denton is the current leader of Atomwaffen Division. Denton, 24, grew up in Montgomery, Texas, a small town about 30 miles north of Houston. Public records show Denton currently lives in the nearby town of Conroe, a few miles to the south of Montgomery. We've obtained several photos of Denton. He's short, wiry, and has long, straight hair. In one photo we've seen, Denton has a bulky combat shotgun slung over his shoulder. Style-wise, he seems to favour camouflage trousers and black t-shirts emblazoned with the logos of National Socialist Black Metal, NSBM, bands. NSBM is a fringe subgenre of black metal music that mixes satanic and Nazi themes. Denton himself used to make NSBM under the name Count Chanath. In the chat logs, we see that Denton very much dictates the current Atomwaffen worldview, saying things like, politics are useless, revolution is necessary. Records and interviews show Denton has chosen to go by the alias Rape in the online conversations. He appears to be involved in nearly every aspect of the organisation. He shapes Atomwaffen's ideology, chooses designs for its distinctive black and white posters and online propaganda, and selects the books that new recruits must study as part of their initiation. This was confirmed to us by the former Atomwaffen member we're talking to. One of the more internally contentious aspects within Atomwaffen is the satanic element that Rape/Denton is introduced to the organisation. He's added a firmly occultist worldview to the group, advocating for the satanic order known as the Order of Nine Angles, O9A. And ensuring Atomwaffen adherents read Iron Gates, a book written by a US-based offshoot of the O9A known as Temple of Blood. Iron Gates is a horrific and badly written fiction book that documents the journey of sadistic militiamen who wreak havoc across an apocalyptic wasteland. Iron Gates begins with a graphic scene where a young baby is sacrificed. This is a book that many in Atomwaffen Division regard highly, second only to Siege. It's also been put on their compulsory reading list. Denton's younger brother, Grayson Patrick Denton, 19, is also a member according to the chat logs and interviews we've done. Within the group, he goes by the name Leon, an homage to a Belgian fascist who fought with the SS. When John Cameron Denton's identity was first revealed last month in a report by the Anti-Defamation League, Denton was seething. "They think they can stop rape. They think they can stop me," Denton wrote in one chat message we've seen, all caps. Neither Denton brother responded to messages from us when we sought comment. Just how many people belong to Atomwaffen is unknown. The ex-member told us that the group has enlisted about 80 members across the country, many of whom joined after the deadly events in Charlottesville last summer. An internal Atomwaffen document we obtained shows members scattered across 23 US states and also Canada. The group's largest chapters are based in Virginia, Texas, and Washington, according to a message posted in the chat by an Atomwaffen recruiter last summer. "Each chapter operates independently," wrote the recruiter. "We want men who are willing to be the boots on the ground. Joining us means serious dedication, not only to the Atomwaffen division and its members, but to the goal of total Aryan victory." A review of the chat logs shows messages posted by people using more than 100 different usernames. Access to the discussions is tightly controlled, and it's unclear if some members post under multiple usernames. Denton has helped build the organization around the ideas expressed in the aforementioned Siege, an obscure, hyperviolent book. The 563-page book collects and organizes the monthly newsletters produced during the 1980s by James Mason. It is required reading for all Atomwaffen members and serves as the backbone for the organization's ideology, worldview, and training program. When Mason began publishing his newsletter in 1980, he was bitter and deeply dismayed. He had devoted his life to the fascist cause, joining the American Nazi Party in the mid-1960s at the age of just 14. But the movement had completely failed. For Mason, the way forward was obvious. He no longer wanted to convince the masses of the relevance of Nazism. They would never get it anyway. Now was the time for the true believers to go underground and launch clandestine guerrilla war aimed at bringing down the system. That being any lever of government that doesn't align with the ultra-violent ideals of neo-Nazism. Siege is essentially a long string of essays celebrating murder and chaos in the name of fascism and white supremacy. In Mason's view, Dan White, the local politician who assassinated San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and gay civil rights leader Harvey Milk, was a hero. Mason proposed the creation of a white liberation front composed of small armed groups that would hide in wilderness areas, moving frequently from location to location while striking out in a string of hit-and-run engagements. Mason based this proposed organization on the short-lived National Socialist Liberation Front, a small splinter group of the American Nazi Party that formed in 1969 and espoused the strategic use of political guerrilla warfare. The chat logs show that Denton and other Atomwaffen figures are in contact with Mason, who is 65 now and is said to be living in Denver, Colorado. In one online conversation, Samuel Woodward wrote about meeting with Mason face-to-face along with other Atomwaffen members. In chats, members frequently post pictures of Mason and revere him as a brilliant, underappreciated thinker. We were unable to contact James Mason. Jeffrey Kaplan, an academic at King Fahd Defense College in Riyadh, interviewed Mason in the 1990s. He spoke to us about Mason's outlook and the groups he inspires, such as Atomwaffen. He describes Mason as a true believer. "Now he's got a following, which he didn't have for the last 30 years," Kaplan said. "He's got some kids who've rediscovered him. He must be in heaven." As Kaplan sees it, groups such as Atomwaffen, that is, would-be Nazi guerrillas devoted to a racist white power revolution in the US, are akin to cults and propelled by a quasi-religious faith that they will ultimately prevail. It seems, based on interviews and the extra material we obtained, that John Cameron Denton, or RAPE, comes across as something as a small-time cult leader. Lately, he's been pushing for Atomwaffen members to pool money and purchase land in rural areas so they can get the fuck off the grid and begin implementing their revolutionary agenda. The former member said Denton envisions using this network of Atomwaffen compounds to launch attacks against targets in the US. Denton is already girding for a confrontation with law enforcement. "I do expect that one day I'll get raided," he wrote in one chat message. "I'm not going to have a shootout or anything stupid like that, but I just don't rule out possibilities because I know the government doesn't play by the rules." Late last month, Atomwaffen held a 3-day training camp, or hate camp as they call it, deep in the Nevada desert. The event was organized by an atom often cell leader named Michael Lloyd Hubsky. Online, he calls himself Commissar, according to the chat logs. A 29-year-old resident of Las Vegas, Hubsky holds both a concealed weapons permit and a security guard license. He's a big fan of high-powered military-style firearms. In one post, he discussed a favorite weapon, a checkmade rifle called a CZ Scorpion that Hubsky claimed he'd converted to fully automatic and equipped with a flash suppressor. In another message, Hubsky wrote that he was planning on getting an FFL, a federal firearms license, so he could manufacture his own guns. "I can literally become our armory in the event we need it," Hubsky bragged. The former member we're speaking to said Atomwaffen has a rule: don't talk about the group's terrorist ambitions in online chats or on social media. Those sorts of conversations are only supposed to happen in person. But Hubsky, at times, has been less than discreet outside of the group's confidential in-person conversations. "So in any war, you need to cut off your enemy's ability to shoot, move and communicate," Hubsky wrote in a September 2017 message posted in a discussion on white nationalism that occurred in a non-Atomwaffen chat room. "You would want to target things like substations, water filtration plants, etc." Hubsky wrote that he had a map of the US power grid. "West Coast only," he added in the message. "Classified map. Had someone with special permissions get it." Hubsky also discussed blowing up natural gas lines. "You put a homemade thermite grenade on those," he wrote. While other types of infrastructure, like water lines, figured in Hubsky's discussions, hitting the power grid was, in his view, the most devastating and effective attack possible. "Destroying electricity infrastructure," Hubsky wrote, "would by default take out the internet because it relies on power to operate." In a telephone conversation and subsequent series of text messages from us, Hubsky at first denied being a member of Atomwaffen, but he later offered to discuss the group at length if his name was not made public, an arrangement we refused to agree to. Hubsky acknowledged that he owns a CZ Scorpion assault rifle, even sharing a picture of the weapon with us for some reason, but he said it was not fully automatic. He concluded the exchange by saying he had retained a lawyer. Hubsky's organization of the three-day hate camp in Nevada began with a proposal to the group late last year. He offered to arrange it so the group could hone its combat skills. There would be shooting and hand-to-hand sparring at a secret location on the edge of Death Valley. Atomwaffen had already held a hate camp in the Shawnee National Forest in southern Illinois during the autumn of 2017. At least 10 members from the different states attended, with some driving in from as far away as Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, and New Jersey. In the Pacific Northwest, cell members had converged on an abandoned cement factory known as Devil's Tower near the small town of Concrete, Washington. We managed to track down the area based off of some obscure graffiti shown in one of the Atomwaffen propaganda videos at Devil's Tower, where they scream, "Gas the kikes, race war now," while aimlessly firing off hundreds of live rounds from any array of different weapons, including an AR-15 assault rifle fitted with a high-capacity drum magazine. Atomwaffen members have also organized smaller training sessions, such as the one last year in Texas that had drawn Blaze Bernstein's alleged murderer, Samuel Woodward. The Texas training attended by Woodward took place in the countryside outside San Antonio and involved 10 members of the Texas cell who took part in firearms, survival and weapons instruction. Hubsky scheduled his training camp during the last weekend in January. Atomwaffen's Washington chapter leader, Caleb J. Cole, who uses the alias Khmer or Kim, agreed to help organize the desert training session in Nevada, which the group started calling the Death Valley Hate Camp. "Bring your uniform, rifle slash sidearm, and whatever camping gear you need," he wrote. Cole, who is 22 and lives close to the Canadian border in the town of Blaine, is a National Socialist black metal enthusiast and O9A adherent like Denton. Cole holds a concealed firearm permit and owns an AK-47. In 2015, while Cole was living in Bellingham, police responded to a report that he had Nazi memorabilia in his residence, according to Lieutenant Danette Beckley of the Bellingham Police Department. He was also reported to police in the island town of Ancortes for allegedly harassing a Jewish grocery store owner by waving a Nazi flag in front of the business, according to two law enforcement sources. The former Atomwaffen member told us that Caleb Cole wields a significant degree of influence over the organization's propaganda, recruitment, and organization apparatus. We could not reach Cole for comment. When the group got out to the desert for the Death Valley hate camp, Hubsky made sure they shot photos and videos to be used in Atomwaffen recruiting clips. In one unreleased picture we obtained, an Atomwaffen member is standing at the base of a sand dune showing off a military-grade weapon, an MCX Virtus rifle made by Sig Sauer. He's also holding a flag bearing the Atomwaffen insignia, a black shield bearing the radioactivity symbol. Another member, clutching an assault rifle, is also in the photo. Hubsky returned from Death Valley enthused and eager to do more training. He uploaded a memo to the Atomwaffen chat. It said that members would now be required to join Front Sight, a private combat training facility outside of Las Vegas in the small desert town of Pahrump. Front Sight, the memo said, could provide classes in Uzi and full auto M16 combat, as well as knife fighting, hand-to-hand combat, and instruction in climbing and rappelling. I don't know anything about this group, Bill Cookston, Front Sight's director of operations, said this week. If anyone were to be doing something against the law or in a radical manner, we would look into that. Shortly afterward, Michael Meacher, Front Sight CEO, said the training center had sent Hubsky a letter refunding his membership fees and informing the Las Vegas resident that he was banned from the facility for life. Before Samuel Woodward was jailed on charges of murdering Blaze Bernstein, he frequently participated in the Atomwaffen chats. First, he used the handle Saboteur. Later, he posted under the name Arn. Often, Woodward sounded like a typical 20-year-old. He raved about video games, mostly Bioshock and Skyrim, and TV shows. He liked the early seasons of Trailer Park Boys. He complained about not having a girlfriend. But Woodward also railed at, quote, mongrels and Jews and gays. He is a deeply angry and prejudiced young man. He praised Mein Kampf and seemed to regard Siege as something akin to divine revelation. From Woodward's perspective, violence and society-shaking mayhem were the only options for a true Nazi like himself. This orientation attracted him to outlaw groups like the National Socialist Underground, NSU, a German organization that carried out a large-scale terror spree between 2001 and 2011. They robbed 14 banks, planted bombs, and murdered 10 people, most of them immigrants. The NSU was pretty cool, Woodward wrote in the chats. In one conversation, Woodward discussed the Bosnian Civil War of the 1990s, during which Serbian soldiers and paramilitary fighters raped thousands of Bosnian Muslim women as part of an infamous campaign of ethnic cleansing. The only acceptable case of miscegenation is what the Serbs did to captured Bosniak women, he wrote in November 2017. Clearly, Woodward liked the idea of using rape to terrorize women of color, whom he saw as his foes. Force them to carry around the spawn of their master and enemy, he wrote. We sought comment on the chats from Woodward's lawyer, Edward Manoz, but did not get a response. On January 26th, we published a story revealing Woodward's belief in Nazism and exposing his involvement with Atomwaffen. While the article attracted the attention of Atomwaffen members, who promptly posted it to their online chats, no one in the group expressed any sympathy for Bernstein, the young man Woodward allegedly murdered. They made jokes about his slaying and used slurs to describe him. If there was worry, it was about Woodward possibly having to do time behind bars for the murder. Sam did something stupid, wrote one member. Not that that faggot kike didn't deserve to die, just simply not worth a life in prison for. Sean Michael Fernandez, an Atomwaffen leader in Texas, who is also a huge NSBM fan and 098 adherent, even saw an upside for the group. Fernandez, who used the alias Werewolf, believed that Atomoffen actually stood to benefit from the increased notoriety stemming from Woodward's affiliation with the neo-Nazi group and the Bernstein murder. "We're only going to inspire more copycat crimes in the name of AWD, Atomoffen Division. All we have to do is spread our image and our propaganda," Fernandez wrote on January 30th. He continued, "The growing fear is what we set out to do, and it's working exactly how I wanted it to since we took over leadership. I couldn't have planned this better, seriously." For his part, Denton, the National Atomoffen leader, felt betrayed as we'd interviewed a former member for the story. Denton also believes that someone currently within the ranks is sharing information with the media. He seems paranoid. "Looks like AWD needs another purging," he wrote. Members began speculating about who was talking to outsiders. Was it a current member? Was it someone they'd kicked out recently? Members also directed their rage toward the media. As they saw it, Woodward was the one being victimized. Now that his involvement with Atomoffen had spilled out into the public sphere, Orange County prosecutors might hit him with hate crimes charges, charges that could potentially add years to a prison sentence. "We really owe those dues at ProPublica," wrote one member. Woodward posted many members of messages to the Atomoffen chats, but on January 5th, he typed out a few lines that are quite distinct from all the rest. In them, the raging young man suddenly became highly sentimental. "Hey everyone," he wrote, "I just wanted to let you all know I love you so much." 2 days earlier, according to prosecutors, he had buried Bernstein's lifeless body in a shallow grave in a park in California after stabbing him to death. Note, around a year and a half after our initial investigation into Atomoffen Division, many of its main members were arrested and are now facing charges that range from hate crimes and the sharing of child abuse images to the use of an unlawful weapon and harassment. John Cameron Denton, alias Rape, is currently in prison, as is Caleb Cole, Keem, and several other Atomoffen affiliates. Art smuggling as art. Meet the world's most successful art smuggler. 2012. A man named Michelle Van Ryan was once wanted by authorities all over the world for sneaking valuable pieces of art across sea and land. He turned the craft of international art smuggling into an art in its own right. With millions in the bank, Michelle lived the life of a playboy. He owned private planes, enjoyed a harem of beautiful women, and did business with some of the world's most dangerous criminals, many of whom he claims were members of various different governments across the world. Art smuggling has been Michelle's racket since he was 20 years old. Dealing with upper-class gangsters and supposedly legitimate art dealers, he claims to have been shot, extradited, jailed, and hunted by MI6 and Interpol. He once even received photos of his children in the mail, intended as a sinister threat from his enemies. He allegedly had so many contracts on his head that Scotland Yard detectives placed bets on how long he had left to live before he was murdered by a hitman. He hasn't given many interviews over the last 5 years, but I managed to track him down. After speaking to him on and off for several months, Michelle eventually agreed to speak to me on the record about the lucrative world of art smuggling and how he became the kingpin of it. What follows is an edited transcript of our interview. Jake: art smuggling doesn't seem like a very easy thing to get into. How did you first get involved? Michelle: well, by the time I was 15, I'd been kicked out of 7 schools. I must have been ADHD or whatever, because I fucking hated school and was always looking to start something for myself. So I began importing cheap hippie coats from Istanbul. They were basically sheepskins turned inside out with some sleeves on them. I began selling them in this hashish bar in Holland. They sold like fucking hotcakes. So I was going up and down between Istanbul and Holland quite a lot. Business was going well and I was eventually approached in Istanbul by a man named Agdam. Agdam was established in the international art market as well as the black market at the time. He must have seen some potential in me. Obviously, you had to take risks in the art smuggling world, and he probably saw me as somebody who would take them, which was indeed true. I had a Dutch passport as well, which I'm sure didn't hurt. So Agdam wanted me to take these stolen antique Byzantine oil lamps and crucifixes back with me to Holland. I did and sold them for top dollar to private collectors in Europe. Happy with my work, the next time he took me to Armenia. He was smuggling, of course, and when we got there, we had drinks with the chief of police. There was a big organization bringing in lots of pieces from Moscow and Leningrad. The Russians and the Armenians were like mafia clans. They were very well organized and working together. From there, we took a bunch of art and flew to Beirut. The customs there were in on the game. We paid them off. That was basically the first time I smuggled on a large scale. Jake, what were you smuggling? Michelle, Fabergé icons. There were crates and crates and crates of them. I saw them being loaded onto the plane as I was sitting inside, only half believing that it was happening like this. You see your own luggage going onto the plane, followed by three tremendous crates filled with stolen art. Jake, some have called you the world's most successful art smuggler. That's a big title. What does it take to get to that level? Michelle, it is a very pretentious title, but yeah, I was a big time smuggler. I was very ambitious. It all started to get serious when I went to Russia after Beirut. In Russia, the art smugglers all worked together so that they could have their claws in many different countries overseas. So if you were in the game and a promising prospect like I probably was, and had contacts with one clan, you could have contacts with all the clans. I was involved in a big way because I knew all the people and could reach out to them. I could get to the countries behind the Iron Curtain. I was also dealing with VIPs. Don't think this was some kind of scumbag organization. We were dealing with people who were very high up on the political ladder. All you had to do was make sure everybody had his cut. I remember having dinners with VIPs and there'd be a hooker under the table. You'd have to try to keep your face straight while she crawled around giving all the blokes blowjobs. If you couldn't keep your face straight while she was sucking you off, you had to pay the bill. I also learned to drink in Russia, because if you didn't drink with them, they didn't trust you. So I learned to buy the icons like this. Holds a hand over one of his eyes to show how drunk he was. I really learned the basics here. The Russians are very educated. I had a great time, which made me forget that this was my university. This was the first time I learned about big smuggling. There was a black market, and I became an outlet who had the possibilities to market everything in the West. Jake, who were you smuggling the art to? Michelle, well, you would plant things at auctions. I had a gallery and there were straightforward buyers in the market who you could be a middleman to. The profit was tremendous. Jake, were the people you sold to aware that it was smuggled art they were dealing with? Michelle, oh fuck yes. Look, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but the art market is a $1 billion industry. If it, smuggling, is not tolerated on certain levels, the banks would never reach their peaks. I had people on my payroll at customs. It was barely even necessary to smuggle because you could bring it in almost officially so long as you pay a little bit to the right people. Jake, what's the most expensive piece you ever smuggled? Michelle, I'm not going to bullshit you. Single shipments from Russia were between 1 and 3 million, which in the 60s was a lot of money. And these were regular trips, twice a month. It was raining money. So I made my base in Beirut. Money-wise, Beirut was a free banking market. So you could exchange $1 million completely open on the square and no one would ask any questions. Of course, you had to play the cat and mouse game with Interpol. Jake, how did you manage to get away from them so many times? Michelle, you always have to be a step ahead of them. Most of them you could pay off, but some you couldn't. I was cocky. I would show off in their faces sometimes. It was stupidity, but I saw the news of my smuggling in the papers and I liked it. It showed them I could still do it even though they were after me. Also, I'd travel on fake passports, change my appearance. Instead of blue eyes, I change them to brown with contacts. I dye my hair blonde. All those corny tricks. At that time, they worked.
Jake.
Eventually, you began working with the police, though. What made you flip?
Michelle.
Well, I'd been on the run and was eventually arrested at my villa in Marbella. I knew one of the Italian godfathers of the mafia who also has a villa there. We are great friends. So within 10 minutes of being arrested, his counselor was in my cell. He said, Felice cannot come, but he sent you his kind regards. So then I was sent to Madrid, where I dined with a very important member of the police. He arranged for me to go to prison there instead of being extradited to France, where they were really after me. I had the best time of my life in jail in Madrid. I had the guarantee I was coming out in a year, and I bought a cell phone from one of the ETA boys in there. It was like that movie Goodfellas. I had my own kitchen, my own shower, and every day I could bribe one of the guards to go to the market. It was fantastic.
Jake,
it sounds mental.
Michelle,
it was, but things changed later when I went to the Jos Plateau in Nigeria. I saw these incredible Nok terracotta heads that they bury in the graves of their ancestors. They were potentially million-dollar pieces, and I was there to buy them. But then I met the people. The Jos Plateau is very cold at night, so we sat around campfires. And they hardly had anything to eat, yet they sit up all night to protect their ancestors' culture from vultures who want to come and dig and steal and kill to get the terracottas. That touches your heart. You can't deal with those things. You don't want to have people dying for art. It was all just a game, but then I was on top of that hill and suddenly confronted with reality. If that doesn't change you, you aren't a human being. After that, there were a lot of stolen knock pieces that were going to be exhibited at a gallery in London. All were worth around $400,000. They'd be sold to some of the wealthiest people in the world. I could have easily made a lot of money for myself by approaching the dealer and saying, give me 100 grand to keep my mouth shut about where they came from, and I would have got it in a nanosecond. But instead, I went to the Nigerian embassy and I convinced the ambassador there about these stolen knock pieces. We went with the police and about 20 Nigerians into the gallery the day before the opening. There were all of these fucking posh people sipping champagne, and in we came to shut it down. You should have seen their fucking jaws. I made a statement. Don't touch the heritage of these people. And it's not that I was a white knight, not at all, but I began to come across certain things that I just couldn't step over.
Jake, when you flipped, several contracts were put on your head. How did you survive with a bunch of hitmen after you?
Michelle, I always faced my problems. You have to show some balls. Funnily enough, a lot of these hitmen, if they are cut from the right cloth, will come to you with a certain respect if you don't hide. When the Yugoslavian mafia were going to kidnap my father and brother for trying to set a sting operation against them, I had to come back to Amsterdam to face it. I said, okay, come along. If you're going to kill me, kill me. If you want my money, go fuck yourself. That's the language they speak. I was standing with my bodyguards on the terrace in Amsterdam, and this car flew past and they started shooting at me. A bullet went straight through my leg.
Jake. Ouch, what was that like?
Michelle. Just a scratch.
Jake.
To be honest, I'm surprised you're still alive.
Michelle.
Look, I've been shot at on 3 separate occasions. I've had guns on my head. I've had police chasing me. To survive, I have been a chameleon. As you know, I speak many languages. Also, I'm not attached to anything. It's like living near a fault line. If you hear a noise, pack your things and get the fuck out of there. Don't become too accustomed to anything. I can sleep like a baby on a little field bed.
Jake.
Okay, thanks, Michelle. See you later.
Michelle.
Ciao.
No Chance Adana, stuck in a Turkish prison, 2015. The smell of deep heat filled the air inside the TV room of the Adana Detention Centre in southern Turkey. Next to me, an Afghan refugee rubbed the pain relief gel into the arm of a Chechen. The Chechen, an ISIS fighter who'd been caught at the Syrian border, had 3 bullet hole-shaped scars and a surgical incision mark in his pale skin. Sat around this small, sweaty room were refugees and fighters from Cameroon, Iran, Syria, Palestine, and Afghanistan. We shared cigarettes and drank tea as Turkey versus Lithuania played on the TV.
The refugees would boo and hiss every time Turkey took a shot on goal. None of them wanted Turkey to win. I too was rooting for Lithuania. I wasn't at the detention centre as an observer, but as an inmate. I was there waiting to be processed for deportation back to the UK with my friend and colleague Phil Pendlebury. Prior to this, we'd spent the last 8 days locked up in squalid solitary holding cells and in two hellish F-type maximum security prisons. This was all the result of being arrested on August 27th, 2015 in Diyarbakir in southeast Turkey, 345 miles away from Adana. In the southeast, an outbreak of separatist-related violence between the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, and the Turkish state has been spiralling out of control since July. Over 100 policemen and soldiers have been killed by the PKK since the fighting broke out, and Turkey has launched airstrikes on PKK positions, claiming to have killed thousands of militants, numbers that are likely exaggerated. Phil, myself and our colleague Mohamed Rasul were in Turkey to cover the conflict. With a tense political situation and worsening bloodshed, journalists are becoming less welcome in the country by the day. We discovered this on the night of our arrest when we were charged, bizarrely, with assisting the Islamic State and plotting to blow up a police station. The charges, completely fabricated by the Turkish police, changed several times as the investigation went on. No evidence was put to us whatsoever that could possibly support any of them. The charges were ridiculous. The reasons for our arrest were clear. The Turkish state wanted to silence and discredit our journalism. We were reporting on their war crimes and flagrant disregard for the safety of Kurdish civilians. This is something the state doesn't want anyone to know about. What's most distressing, though, is that our friend Rasul still remains behind bars in a Turkish prison. Phil, Rasul, and me were friends beforehand, but after spending 8 arduous days together in the Turkish prison system, we bonded deeply. We'd been constantly pushed around by angry ultra-nationalist Turkish policemen, one of whom threatened to shoot us in the face with his gun loaded in the back of a car, handcuffed for 7 hours in the back of a sweltering military vehicle without water, and we slept on filthy mattresses and concrete floors. Despite all of this, we'd managed to hold it together well by finding support in each other. So when a prison guard told me and Phil that we were free, it was all the more heartbreaking that we had to leave Rasul behind. We wrapped our arms around him and promised him we'd fight for him on the outside. His face was blank, completely shocked. He just nodded and said, "Get me out of here, guys." Within 30 seconds, we were rushed out of the cell. Being white and Western with British passports, both Phil and I were released from the F-type prison early. Unlike us, Rasul, as a Kurdish Iraqi citizen, didn't have a powerful government going to bat for him behind the scenes. So Phil and I were taken to the Adana detention centre, where for 3 days we lived among imprisoned refugees, former Syrian rebels, and captured members of the Islamic State. Upon arrival, we had no idea how long we would be staying or why we were there. We'd been out of prison maybe 30 minutes before we were driven there by 2 silent policemen. The other inmates stopped and stared at us as we were pushed through the iron gates at the entrance of the wing. We were a wreck. Our shirts were stiff with dirt. We hadn't had a proper wash for over a week. We'd slept on concrete floors, and I'd lost about 1 stone in weight. We were, again, the only 2 Westerners in the whole facility, which housed around 100 people. In the F-type prison, there had been no mixing of the general population due to the maximum security status. Now, though, we were in with everyone else. "Now we're really fucked," I said to Phil. "Yep," he replied, fake smiling and nodding at everyone. We made our way down the wing, which consisted of 1 narrow 20-foot corridor with 6 rooms to each side. At the end of the corridor was a communal shower and toilet room. To the right of this was the TV room. Conditions here weren't great, but compared to the prisons we'd just been in, it was like the Ritz. A stout Iranian guy in his early 50s, with a grey goatee and a few broken teeth, greeted us in basic English. "Hello," he grinned. "Don't worry, come with me." The Iranian explained where we were. The other inmates were, for the most part, actually just refugees who'd been caught by the Turkish authorities and put into the detention centre. Theoretically, they awaited deportation. According to UNHCR, over 1.7 million refugees reside in Turkey, making it the largest refugee hosting country in the world. The people in Adana had made their way across the country's borders too. In the detention centre now, they have no idea when they're getting out. Most have been here for months. "It's okay, this is not prison," added the Iranian, who'd been in detention for 41 days. There were bars at the windows and padlocks on the gates. It was a kind of prison, a prison for refugees. "We figured we were going to be deported sooner or later after we saw ourselves on Al Jazeera in the Wings TV room. The news of our release from prison splashed across the screen with pictures of me and Phil. We were sat with a 22-year-old Afghan refugee named Ali." He burst out laughing. By this point, any fears we had of getting lynched in the showers had all but gone. People welcomed us. They gave us sachets of granulated coffee, which we treasured like liquid gold after a week on a bread and water prison diet. Ali helped us settle in. He seemed to be the Wing's tough guy. He wore a vest at all times and followed a strict fitness regime of press-ups and star jumps every morning after his prayers. People were constantly calling his name to sort out minor disputes or dish out the meals at dinner time. Ali arranged a bunk bed for us in his room. We shared the room with two guys in their 20s, Heli from Palestine and Supa from Afghanistan. The older Iranian guy was also in with us. Heli took an immediate shine to us. He was almost always smiling, a smile that was crooked due to a deep scar in his top lip. His body was littered with old wounds, most of which were the result of a bomb blast in Gaza last summer, which killed his mother, father, and six sisters, or so he said. The scars starting at his wrists and leading up his arm were different, though. He'd been cutting himself out of desperation. "I started cutting myself to get service," he said. Service being some, any form of attention from the prison guards. The only way to get hold of them was to bang the padlock of the iron gates of the wing until someone came, which often took ages. After 6 months in the detention centre, Heli was particularly distressed because he hadn't heard from his pregnant wife or their young daughter. "I called, but the number doesn't go through. Now the guards won't give me any more phone calls." Despite his constant grin, Heli had a deep sadness about him. He pointed out the window that evening as we watched the sunset, poking his hands through the bars to make an aeroplane taking off gesture. "Soon you will go back to England. Me, I've been here for so long. I need to go, but no chance, Adana. No chance." Then he popped open a packet of crisps and poured a glass of Pepsi for us to share. After being forced to drink warm, strongly chlorinated water from the F-Type's dodgy prison tap during one particularly grim night, this impromptu snack was an act of kindness I could never repay or explain to Heli. We sat drinking Pepsi and eating crisps as the sun went down. That night, Ali ran in and out of our room for hours. The light would flick on and off. The door slammed. He'd rush out, rush back in. I asked Super what was happening. Super spoke perfect English and helped us all communicate. "Ali caught someone cutting their wrists in the toilets," he said. "I don't know. I think he was depressed. He's one of the Somalian guys." The next day at breakfast, the guy who'd slashed his wrist sat next to me. He looked as if life was slowly draining out of him. A blood-soaked strip of bedsheet administered by Ali was bound around his left wrist. He wasn't taken to hospital, and the guards were unaware he'd cut himself. The lad was 20 and had been detained for 4 months. Desperate acts like this were a regular occurrence inside the detention centre. We'd sit for hours with the guys, talking amongst ourselves in varying levels of broken English and sequential translations. They'd ask us questions about the West, usually about the women. We'd explain to them the best we could and ask them about their journeys, families and lives before Adana. They became our friends. On our last night inside the Adana detention centre, Heli took us into a room up the hall. A group of Syrian refugees had invited us to join them. They were singing anti-Assad songs, dancing and pouring us ridiculously strong cups of granulated coffee. They were in good spirits, all claiming to be former fighters of the Free Syrian Army, the FSA, in Aleppo. Phil and I were leaving in a few hours. Our deportation flight was booked for 3 a.m. Thank fuck. We celebrated with Heli and the Syrians, singing along with them, laughing, joking. The noise could be heard throughout the whole wing. People popped their heads in to say hello and sing along too. Then the extremists arrived. "I am Mujahideen," screamed some fat guy from Tajikistan, who had, characteristically for an extremist, come to ruin the fun. "Children are being killed in Syria. I came to fight. I am Mujahideen." An argument broke out between the admitted jihadists, who the Iranian and many others informed us were openly ISIS fighters who'd been picked up at the Syrian border, and the FSA guys. The jihadists were unhappy that the others were having a laugh with the kuffar, me and Phil. There were around 15 Islamic extremists at the detention centre, mostly from Chechnya. At least three of them were wounded. One even had an open bullet hole shaped wound in his hand that leaked pus all day long. Horrible. They tolerated us for the last 3 days, some were even friendly, but clearly enough was enough. The FSA guys argued back angrily. One of them pointed at three of the guys we'd been drinking coffee with. "Commando, commando, commando," he said as he pointed at each one. The fat jihadist from Tajikistan eventually shut his mouth and left. We went back to our room with Heli. He reassured us, with a cutthroat sign to his neck, that if the ISIS fighters came for us, he would kill them. It was somewhat reassuring, especially after we'd seen Ali fashion a knife out of a sharpened teaspoon and a lighter the day before. It was hidden somewhere in our room. It then occurred to us that we were perhaps under some type of informal protection with Ali. I'd later learn after being released that Super and Ali had stopped a plot where several of the Chechen jihadists planned to cut off mine and Phil's heads in the toilets. Back in the room, Heli was depressed. He was furious about the extremists and sad that we were leaving, as was Ali, who'd slept all day and seemed moody. "You're born in England, so you're Christian," said Heli. "I'm agnostic, but whatever," I nodded. "I'm born in Gaza, so I'm Muslim. But there is no difference between us." He clasped his hands together. "Friends." He touched his chest where his heart was. "If you look at me, you see I am always smiling and I look happy. But inside I am..." He couldn't find the words. Instead, he just hung his head. "No chance of Dana." A few hours later, the guards came to get me and Phil. We said our goodbyes before being driven to the airport and deported. It felt good to be free, but the joy was overshadowed by the fact that we'd left Rasul behind in Turkey. He is still locked up in the F-type as the investigation continues, held purportedly on suspicion of knowingly and willingly helping an organised criminal group without being part of the hierarchical structure of the group, a provision increasingly used by the Turkish regime to target and intimidate journalists. Rasul is innocent of these crimes. Phil and I wait anxiously for the news that he too has been pushed through the iron gates at Adana, ready to be sent back to freedom. Note: Rasul was released after 131 days in prison. Eventually, he managed to leave Turkey and is now living safely elsewhere. That was Gargoyle, written and narrated by myself, Jake Hanrahan.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.